Thank you. I have no idea what format you use. Is it
Oh, don't
like
worry.
a talk and you interrupt all
No
the
matter
time?
what the
So,
format
okay.
is, we won't interrupt.
Okay, excellent. So I will try and summarize some of the stuff that we've done in the past and also give you an idea of what we're doing at the moment and where it's leading. Essentially, we're very much interested in systems aspects of representation of sensory stimuli, in particular olfaction at the moment. And we're just by working in that system, we found that there are lots of dynamical issues and dynamical phenomena, at least that take place in the system, such as synchronization, such as slow temporal patterning of responses over the duration of a stimulus. And we're trying to understand the mechanisms that cause those phenomena and also the reasons why they exist. And if anything, I'll try and provide possibly two answers to the question, what role do those phenomena play? And as you'll see, they depend on which ones we look at and what region of the brain we look at them. So I'll get to it in this series of introductory slides. The olfactory system is interesting because for many reasons. One of them is that it's very different from the senses that are normally favored by physiologists and physicists, such as vision and hearing. Most likely because the stimulus is a lot more difficult to control and so much less has been done on it. But it appears that its structure also is very different, and the way in which it represents and encodes information may also be quite different. So all of this has led to a lot of interest recently that was in fact mainly triggered by the work that was done by molecular biologists and started mainly by Linda Buck and Richard Axel in the early 90s when they cloned the first family of odorant receptor genes. And that opened the way to very precise anatomical description of projection patterns from the nose onwards. That's been done in vertebrates and also now in flies. So all of this confirms a feeling that everybody had before that, even that before that detailed knowledge, which is that the basic organization structure of olfactory circuits is very similar across organisms, going from mollusks up to insects, any kind of arthropods, crustacea, etc., up to all the vertebrates, reptiles, fish, up to mammals. What you have always is in the periphery a first set of olfactory neurons or receptor neurons that transduce this information. And there is a very large number of them in general. And in most systems that have been studied, individual neurons express a single odorant receptor gene, but each odorant receptor gene appears to be not terribly specific, that is, responsive to a wide number of potential molecules. So the number of genes that have been identified going down from about 1,000 in mammals down to a few tens. In the case of Drosophila, there's probably about 50 of them. After this station, which transduces information, yeah. Say again.
50 genes may still mean that there are more than 50 kinds of receptors.
So first, it could be that not all the genes have been identified, which is very possible. Second, it could be that individual receptor neurons express several combinations of those receptor genes, and that doesn't appear to be the case in the systems that have been studied in detail, like mouse and like Drosophila now. It appears that neurons in general express a single one. There's exception. In the fly, there's a few neuron types that appear to express a couple of receptors, but otherwise, in general, it's one neuron, one receptor type. And what you find is that there is a very large number of receptors that express the same gene, and they all converge to the same very small number, 1, 2, 3, but rarely more than that, glomeruli, which are the stations where the axons of these neurons terminate in that first relay. And so usually there's a good correspondence between the number of genes that exist in species and the number of glomeruli that you find at one station beyond that. Okay, so in the mouse, for example, the family of receptor neurons that express the same receptor gene project to two glomeruli in each olfactory bulb, one on the medial part, one on the lateral part, dorsal or ventral. But in any case, what you find is there's 1,000 genes and there's 2,000 glomeruli, 1,800 glomeruli in rats, for example. So it's a very good correspondence. Okay. The second relay for this information is called the olfactory bulb. It's called the antenna lobe in insects, the bulb in vertebrates. And it's a structure that's characterized by glomeruli, which are little spheres of neuropil where the axons of the olfactory receptor neurons terminate and contact postsynaptic cells within that circuit. Okay? And so, as I said, the number of glomeruli varies, but it usually corresponds very closely to the number of genes that exist in a given species. Although the number of species in which the total number of genes has been well estimated is still small. It's mice, rat, and it's several mammals, and Drosophila mainly now. Fish is getting there. So it in all these examples, at least, it fits well. Yeah. So in all of these, what you'll find is that, for example, in the mucosa of our nose or that of rats, you'll find several thousand neurons or tens of thousands of neurons that express the same olfactory receptor gene. They will be spread out over a very large proportion of the surface of the epithelium, although not the entire, there are zones that have been characterized. But all of those neurons, then eventually I'll show you a picture, converge onto a couple of glomeruli, one on one side and the other on the other. Some of those genes have actually been found to be expressed in the testicles. I'm not sure that they've been found in other places, but it appears that those genes, or at least the gene products, the mRNA or the proteins, play some role also in axon guidance, because there's obviously a very complex developmental problem, which is if you have a bunch of neurons that are spread out but have the same molecular and coding identity, they have to find the right targets. And how do you do that? And it appears that the mRNA, and therefore possibly the protein, is actually expressed in the growing axon and helps determine, feel its way as the axon is growing to find its target centrally. So it could very well be that principles like this are used in other systems, and the same or similar genes are expressed in other places just to play that role, but not necessarily a role of sensory transduction. Okay, but waste, I don't know, the olfactory, I mean, the chemical world is extremely difficult to characterize well, and it's actually one thing which I think is fascinating is the fact that the molecular identity of the genes that you find in flies and in fish and in mammals, for example, is completely different. It hasn't been possible once Linda and Richard cloned the mouse receptor to, by homology, pull out the equivalent genes in many other species. And in fact, now that we know the genes from flies, it's proven impossible to use that to clone by homology again the odorant receptor genes in other insect species. So they might have evolved totally independently, but the principles appear to be conserved. It's always the same global organization, but the molecular identity of these genes seems to change from species to species. And in fact, within one species, you'll find several families that appear to be centered on several classes of odorant molecules. For example, in the case of mammals, you have a vomeronasal system that's thought to be involved in pheromone detection. So a certain class of molecule, which itself is very ill-defined at this time. But again, the family of odorant receptor genes expressed in that system is completely different from that expressed in the main olfactory system. Yeah. So in what sense are they different? we don't know what that, so the sequence is different. There is very, very little. I mean, even within one family in mouse, for example, among the 1,000 genes that exist, you have genes that will have 90%, 95% homology between them, and usually it's thought that they will respond to very similar odorants. But you have others that have very, very little homology, down to 30 or even lower, 30% or even lower, and those are likely to respond to very different kinds of odorants. But nobody knows yet, people are working hard on that, what regions and what portions of those sequences are the ones that do the chemical recognition, in which case that would allow one to just focus on those zones and try and find homology in other systems and other receptor neurons, or receptor genes in other species. And that hasn't been done successfully yet.
But is a basic flavor of coupling to a G protein pathway?
Yeah, so all of these, I didn't say that, yeah, they all seven transmembrane domain G protein coupled receptor types. They're all the same kind of global family. But within that, they can be with very, very little homology between them. Okay? Yeah? Well, I can say something now, but it's
number of vodkas that you can.
Well, that's a lot less. You find numbers in the literature about the number of odors that one can recognize, that humans can recognize, and they're in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands. But when you look for the work that's been done to arrive at those numbers, there's really very, very little that's trustworthy. I'm sure it's very reasonable. I would say that it's probably infinite, that we can smell. First of all, the nature of an odor is complex. Not only does a single molecule, or can a single molecule, have a very characteristic odor, but in nature, most odors are blends. Ground coffee, which this is not really, but ground coffee is about 300 volatile molecules, and it's well known from human psychophysics, at least, that when you mix odors together, when you go beyond three, even for a trained nose, somebody who is very who works in perfumery or wine tasting, it's impossible to segment the components. So there is something very peculiar about this sense, in the sense that it binds everything together and creates a singular percept out of something that may be extremely complex. So given that there are tens of thousands of volatile compounds that we can smell, you can make as many combinations as you want, and all of those will have a peculiar odor. Yeah. As far as memory goes, it's very clear that we can store a very large number of odors, and we can, 20 years later, smell something and immediately recognize it, or at least know that we know it. In insects, a lot of experiments have been done to try and see what the capacity of a honeybee is, for example. And it's very important for them when they go foraging to identify the right sorts of flowers. And at any one time, people have reached numbers like 10 or so, but it's an infinite capacity in the sense that you can always add new odors. It's only that when you test the animals, they seem to forget about others they've stored prior to that. So there's at any one time a capacity of 10, but infinite otherwise, over integrated over the entire life of the animal. So that's, yeah?
I have a question to the architecture. You said they glomerularly same receptor type.
Yes.
The question is, wiring up activity dependent, or does it happen?
People are working on that, and there is some mild debate about whether activity is important or not. It appears that, I'd say that the majority of people think that it's not. That is, for example, the targeting can occur, first of all, before the target cells exist in the system. For example, so the mitral cells can occur and grow their tufts of dendrites within the glomeruli later than the time at which the axons arrive. So of course it doesn't mean that they don't have a target. They probably do have a target, but it may not be neural, it might be glial, it might be something else. And experiments have been done whereby you express in a certain subset, say all the neurons that express certain odorant receptor gene, you express in all of those axons a toxin that prevents release of neurotransmitter. So in all of those axons, even though the neurons might recognize, the information will not be transmitted at the synapse. And even in those animals, it appears that the targeting is done correctly. That's where there is some debate because of the way in which the experiments have been done. But overall, it appears the targeting appears to be correct. So if activity is important, it probably is, you know, mild fine-tuning. It might be important, but it's not finding where to go.
Okay. They have also fixed points to which they convert, like from animal to animal.
Yes, it's incredible. If you look at, first of all, there are two of those, there's a left and a right. So if you look at sections of cross sections of the olfactory bulb of a mouse, where the neurons that express the same odorant receptor gene have been labeled in both on both sides, you'll find two glomeruli in very similar positions in the same plane of section, for example. You find the same thing in across animals in the same species. More or less. I mean, in an animal with 1,800 glomeruli, it's a ballpark. It'll tell you roughly where it is, and there's, of course, some variability across that. Marcus Meister is doing some very nice imaging at the moment in vivo, trying to characterize this, and his results show that there is some variability in the relative position of these glomeruli, but overall, they're always in the same neighborhood.
Are they attracted to a target, or are they clustered together? Like all the axons have something in common that cluster them together, and then they fight something.
It's clear that I'm going in territory that's not the work that I do closely, but I can tell you what I know. Peter Mombart has done some experiments where he tried to let's see how he did those experiments in the class of neurons, olfactory receptor neurons, that express the same receptor gene, he silenced that particular gene and inserted another one to replace it. And the replacement gene was one which was either very close or very different from, in sequence homology, to the one that was being replaced. Okay? And the result, and then he observed in those knock-in mice how those receptor neurons would grow in the animal and go to their normal target area. And through a series of experiments like that, he found that, first of all, that was the first set of experiments that showed that the identity of the receptor gene is important for the targeting. So it implied that it plays a role in the targeting. And second, that receptor genes that have a high sequence homology will have targets that are neighboring to one another. Again, the N is small. It's been done with two or three genes, but so far everything has been the same way. So if you have high sequence homology between two genes, very often they will have targets that are very close to one another. And if you replace one gene by the other, so for example, the gene that targets there, and you replace it by the gene that targets here, what you find is that the new axons now will go neither there nor here, but they will go somewhere in the vicinity. So how that happens...
Is it targeting or clustering? Right?
Well, I'll show you a picture. You'll see very clearly how the axons, as they move, clearly find themselves before they actually reach their target. Okay, so they find some tract, whatever it is. They clearly find each other at different points and eventually find each other, and then they find some target. And people who study the development of the axons of the project actually can film them as they try and, you know, as they arrive at the target, and they seem to hover around some neighborhood. But the precise mechanisms as yet are not known. What are glomeruli? The glomeruli are...
I realized now. I think you should take do you have a slide with sort of some more detailed anatomy than this?
I will have some. I mean, it doesn't bother me at all. It's fun, but
Whether is it going to come up naturally, or do you need to take a few minutes to go to the board and sketch some anatomy? And I apologize.
Yeah, I can give you the broad picture, and then when anatomy comes up, then I can give it. Otherwise, I'm going to go back and forth. I think it's easy enough. I may never reach slide 2 even, but so a glomerulus is not a cellular entity. It's a synaptic, essentially a synaptic entity, a sort of spherical region where you find the axonal terminals of the receptor neurons, the dendritic terminals of cells that receive those inputs, and in the case of the bulb, they are called mitral cells. So you have those contacts between those two sets of cells, but you have other cell types also. In the case of vertebrates, you have periglomerular cells, which are small inhibitory neurons that lie in the periphery of each of them, and that release GABA as a neurotransmitter, and again send axons and dendrites, the two are mixed, within each glomerulus. And then very often, although not in all species, there is around each glomerulus some kind of glial sheath, so that they can be, at least in many species, a sort of tight chemical compartment. And people think that it may play a role. There may be suddenly a very high potassium concentration that might together excite all the postsynaptic cells similarly, or things like this. So do some sort of averaging over a glomerulus in ways that exploit this tight compartmentalization. Okay?
And one glomerulus receives inputs from one receptor
subtype? Yeah. You had a question. There are, at this point, very very few genes for which the chemical specificity has been characterized. There is one that's been characterized in, it's called odor 10. That's been characterized in mice by Stuart Feierstein. And its tuning was thought to be very fine earlier, and now it's found to be a lot broader than was thought originally. But there are, to my knowledge at least, no other similar or very dissimilar genes in that mouse family for which the chemical sensitivity has been characterized. So we don't really know. But it's highly suspected. Well, tuning, yeah. I mean, I'll go somewhat through that. It's a very complex problem in olfaction. How do you define tuning of any cell type? Because going through parameter space is a very difficult thing. So the traditional way that people have used was to go by chemical classes and define an array of olfactory stimuli that will go from aliphatic molecules and ketones, alcohols, acids, and so on, to aromatic ones, etc., and try and visit most basic regions of chemical space, and then try all of these odors on individual neurons. So that's usually the way you do it. Okay? All right, so back to the slide. First relay, which is this olfactory bulb, or called antennal lobe in the insect, there is always a massive convergence between these, in terms of neuron cell numbers, from here to there. Convergence ratios, something like 1,000 to 1, very often, if not more. Okay. Then after that, there's divergence again from this bottleneck to a second structure, which is called the prepiriform cortex, or associated structures in the vertebrate system, telencephalon. There's no real cortex per se in lower vertebrates. Or the mushroom body in insects, which is a structure that we study. And again, there's, as I said, a divergence. Here there's, in the case of the insect species we study, the locust, there's 800 neurons coming out of there, and there's 50,000 targets. So there's a wide degree of divergence from there. That structure is thought to be involved in memory formation, and that's known through a lot of studies that have been done in honeybees and also in Drosophila. A lot of learning mutants, olfactory learning mutants, appear to have defects in second messenger pathways in neurons within the mushroom body. Yeah. There are massive feedback connections in vertebrates from these regions back to the bulb. There's, that I know of, there is no feedback connection to the olfactory receptor neurons. In insects and crustacea, there is some feedback, very little, much, much less than there is in the case of vertebrates.
What's the path? I mean, to go one step beyond, I mean, ultimately the animal makes a simple decision.
Mm-hmm.
He turns his or her orientation. His. And
her. Her.
What?
Her. Yeah. Her. She'll be a forager.
Okay. Okay. So, I mean, what is there a convergence down to a small number of what?
Yeah. Where is the decision?
What are the steps involved in the convergence down to motor control?
We don't know. So I'll show you a slide a bit later on of that structure of the mushroom body and how it's put together. But the mushroom body itself has several hundred target neurons, many of which feed back onto the mushroom body itself, and some of which project to other areas. Also, those acts.
The mushroom body has the most divergent representation.
Mm-hmm.
After the mushroom body, you're starting to converge again.
Yeah, most likely, yes. Okay. Yes, 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 absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry, you were going to
say. I don't know what I was going to say. I'll move on. Okay, so the thing that I'm going to try and get through will basically be these two points. We're trying to understand the role of these structures and also the role of the temporal processes that I will describe that go on in those different circuits. And what they are is essentially said here. So first of all, the receptor neurons. The receptor neurons, obviously, they transduce this chemical information into a set of electrical signals. And as a result of the convergence, they will also increase signal to noise. And that's going to be important for the process that goes on here, which, as I'll explain later, we think is a decorrelation between inputs. So that's the first aspect, and I'll explain to you what we think happens and how. But in addition to this, there is something that's very interesting that's been observed in those structures throughout. It's been known since the work of Adrian in the 40s, which is that upon odor presentation, the olfactory system oscillates. It oscillates, in fact, within several frequency bands, but the one that you find most often is around 10 to 40 hertz or so. And that's a consistent finding that you find in insects, you find in all vertebrates. And of course, a lot of work has been done to try and understand how that's generated, but very little has been done to try and understand what role that might play. And the role that oscillations might play, that's what I'll try and argue towards the end today, is that it ultimately leads to a compression of the representations in this mushroom body structure. And so it will be an optimization of the storage of what an odor memory is. And so what happens in this structure, in addition to the decorrelation, is a formatting for that compression, and that formatting will be essentially create oscillations and oscillatory synchronization in the system. Okay.
I mean, you have proof of these things, or these are just?
I'll try and show you that I have proof for that. And so, but that's the proposal that I'm putting in front of you now, and then I'll give you the data, and then we discuss. I'll be very eager to have your feedback on that. Absolutely. Yeah. Now that's just a kind of summary to give you an idea of where I'm going. So let's look at what happens. Again, it's still summary here, but to give you a flavor of where I'm going. When an odor is presented, because of the lack of specificity of olfactory receptor neurons, the fact that a given olfactory receptor neuron can respond to a wide variety of odorants. Any odor, even if it's a very, very simple one, will activate a large number of receptor neuron types. Okay, so the representation there will be combinatorial at that level. The types of responses that you get from those neurons appear to be all very similar to one another. That is, you get usually a phasic increase in firing rate in those neurons and then a tonic response following that for several seconds, however long you decide to maintain the stimulus. Okay. So there is some sort of patterning of the responses, but it's always the same and across neurons. And that's going to be very different at the station beyond that. Okay. So what you're going to have here is the transduction. And as a result of the convergence of olfactory receptor neurons onto single glomeruli, so that's a picture that illustrates what I was talking about, you know, two slides ago. This is a slide that's been done by Peter Mombarts when he was in Richard Axel's lab, where all the receptor neurons that express the same gene here are stained with this dye, this blue dye. And what you see here is the nasal cavity. You can see these darker areas of the turbinate, the kind of folds and invaginations that the mucosa defines within the nose. The dark dots here each correspond to a single neuron, and the threads correspond to their axons. And so you can see how their axons converge together, form tracks, and eventually converge to one glomerulus, which is this large blob there. And there's another glomerulus which is out of the plane of section of this slide. So what you have here is a very wide distribution, wide spatial distribution of those receptor neurons over the mucosa. And all of them will have, at least presumably, it seems to be true through all the experiments that have been done, the same chemical sensitivity, and they will all converge onto one glomerulus. Well, they will affect a very small number of target cells. In mouse, there's probably about 20 mitral cells that will receive inputs from all those receptor neurons there. So there's a very large degree of convergence, and potentially averaging that will be important.
Increasing signal tonalities is just averaging.
Presumably. There may be other processes, of course.
Maybe this is obvious, but then you're saying the noise source has to do with what? I mean, it only increases signal tonalities if there's independent.
Independent, exactly. But so the important aspect is that all of those are very broadly distributed spatially. So all the local variations in air concentrations, et cetera, and turbulence and motion and so on that you might have here would presumably be uncorrelated with those that occur in other regions. And similarly, the actual biophysical state of those neurons should also be independent of one another. So again, that's a speculation, but the setup appears to be optimal to do that particular kind of averaging, at least.
Olfaction has to do with sniffing, right?
I mean, yeah.
So why the
L-tubulus
would be
isolated? Because, well, over the duration of a sniff, of course, there will be this broad correlation that lasts the duration of a sniff. But within that, exactly, within that, the fine temporal structure will be. I'll show you later on the structure of a plume of odor. It's extremely turbulent and complex, and so you have micro eddies and so on that will most likely be very different here than they are there. In particular, because it goes through all these turbinates, which are these very folded bones that we have inside our nose. So that varies. Presumably, you're talking about direct inputs from the receptors. So in the case of the mammals that have been studied, rats, rabbit, mice, etc., most mitral cells send a dendrite to one single glomerulus. It's not completely true, but most mitral cells do. In addition to the mitral cells, there are tufted cells And those tufted cells, in general, have projections to several glomeruli, maybe five, etc. In insects, you have insects that have projection neurons, I call the analogs of the mitral cells, that project to a single glomerulus. The bee is an example. And others, like the locust, that have projections to several glomeruli, 10, 20 in some cases. So the number of receptor types that they're directly connected to varies between 1 and, say, 20, potentially. I mean, that's it's probably a lot less than that.
And then
That's not known. Or if it is, I don't know about it. I've never seen that addressed in the literature. But as I said, it could very well be. I mean, there are lateral connections within a glomerulus and between mitral cells. There is self-excitation that can occur within the glomerulus. And most likely also release of glutamate by mitral cells within the glomerulus that could affect neighboring mitral cells. So it could very well be that all of those cells respond in very similar ways. It doesn't mean that the output will be similar because their connectivity laterally within the circuit with other cells might be different. That's really not known. But at least the inputs, at least as a first approximation, is probably very similar across all cells. Okay, so the second stage here is one that has for a very long time been proposed to be one where the response profiles of the neurons is being sharpened. And that's an idea that's been put forward mainly by Gordon Shepherd and by Kanzaku Mori over the last 20 years. The basic idea is that a given mitral cell, say the one that projects in these glomerulus, will receive inputs from a very large number of different odors, but that through lateral interactions that occur within the glomerulus, so I didn't mention, but within those circuits are also lateral inhibitory neurons called granule cells in the case of vertebrates that do make connections with secondary dendrites of mitral cells. And the basic idea is one that was taken from the retina literature and thinking, which is that the mitral cells will, via those lateral interactions, inhibitory interactions, become sharpened. Their response profiles will become sharpened. And the basis, the experimental basis for this proposal, come from experiments of Kanzaku Mori, whereby he tested the response profiles of mitral cells to a series of, say, aliphatic aldehydes. And so you would have a carbon chain with 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 carbons, say, and an aldehyde at the end, and test each one of these odors on a given mitral cell. And his data suggest, although I have problems with the data itself, but suggest that a given mitral cell will respond best to a given number of carbon chain, so 4 carbons. And that if you look on each side of this, so 5 and 3 carbons, you'll find a decreased response, and 1 carbon removed from that, even an inhibition of that cell in response to those odors. The data itself, I don't want to. Sorry?
Inhibition, you're saying, there's two things going on. There's a general inhibition and there's an excitation, and you fall below some level of excitation, so inhibition.
Yeah, you go below baseline, so those cells have some sort of baseline activity, and when you give them a C6 aldehyde, then that cell is inhibited.
Because the receptor itself only leads to excitation.
At least in the case of vertebrates, that's all that's been ever described. Yes. Yes.
But wouldn't be a straightforward way of showing that there is an inhibitory interaction between two odors, where there are two cells which are tuned to each one of the odors. If you get both, then
Right, but that's the whole problem with olfaction, which is that it's not really dealing with that kind of stimulus. So at least that's not, it doesn't really want to do, I think, a separation of those two odors in the way that the visual system would want to enhance an edge, for example. It actually, if you give a mixture, what the olfactory system does is create a new odor out of that mixture. Okay, so. To me, even the experiment itself, I don't think will answer that question. But you'll see later on when I show you the fish data that there is another basic problem, which is that I think it's inappropriate to characterize the tuning curves of these cells in the way that has been done, because the response patterns of those cells have a temporal component to them. And the way in which they're characterized always in those experiments is by measuring the average rate over the response duration, which in my view doesn't mean anything at all. And it's a big mistake. So you'll see when I go to the detail, you'll see why.
So when you say shortening, you actually need the from the small fraction of neutral cell.
Well, that would be the sharpening is in the tuning of a given cell, and the implication would be that you would thereby lead to a smaller fraction of the cells responding. And again, this is not something that we find. So for these and other reasons, I don't think that that's really what happens. Rather, what we think happens is that there is a reorganization of the representation from a combinatorial, more or less spatial representation across this ensemble, to a new combinatorial representation which has now a temporal component. And that temporal component is going to be the substrate for this decorrelation. And that's what I'll try and explain. Okay. The mitral cell, so again, you have to, if you look at textbooks, the textbook drawing of a mitral cell is a dendritic tuft in a glomerulus, and then two lateral dendrites that are called secondary dendrites, and then a soma, and then an axon.
The axon goes
beyond, yeah, it even sends collaterals, but you've gone downstream.
The
olfactory bulb, and it goes that way, out. Okay, so within the secondary dendrites are located in a layer that lies just underneath the layer of glomeruli. Okay, so these lateral dendrites overlap with the lateral dendrites, secondary dendrites of other mitral cells that are neighboring, and you have in between granule cells, which are very small and very dense, very numerous inhibitory cells that connect them in a dendrodendritic fashion so that they receive inputs and also make inputs from the same processes. They don't have any axons. Okay? And the basic interpretation of that circuit is that two glomeruli that are close to one another are sensitive to very similar odors. And therefore, what you're going to have is, through this lateral inhibition, a sort of winner-take-all lateral inhibitory tuning and sharpening. The problem with that textbook view is that it never emphasizes the fact that the secondary dendrites can be a millimeter long. They're enormous. And a given, it's also within a plane, so that a given mitral cell itself gives, on average, about six of those secondary dendrites in a plane like this. Over a millimeter in each direction. That is, it covers an enormous amount of the bulb. It lies under a very large number, tens if not hundreds of different glomeruli, enabling interactions with a very large number of other receptor types.
The coupling goes down. The density of contact
goes down. No, it's not so much the density, but it's, at least from the calcium imaging that's been done, it's clear that the intensity of an input that's received very distally and that sense that the soma is much less than one that's very proximal. But at the same time, the more distal you go, the more glomeruli you can visit. So it's unclear that under natural and physiological circumstances, that is not compensated for by the fact that there are many more glomeruli in the distal regions than there are in the proximal ones. So all of this has not really been studied in those conditions.
And the numbers you get before, 800 cells of what?
So that was a locus, that was an insect number.
For
the entire antenna lobe, there's 800 outputs, 830 outputs, mitral cells, projection neurons. Yeah, and 300, sorry?
In mammals?
In mammals, it's so that the outputs are in the few tens of thousands. Okay. So in the case of mice, for example, there's about 20 mitral cells per glomerulus, and there's about 1,800. Yeah, yeah. In rats, there's 40. So it's always in that range. Okay. So our view of what happens in that structure is different. It's not this, but it's rather a reformatting of the information, exploiting those lateral connections that use use inhibition but also excitation, so as to eventually lead to a decorrelation that I'll describe in a second. But let's just look at the data. These are simultaneous recordings that we do with tetrodes from the locust antenna lobe. And each one of these rasters, each one of these PSTHs here is constructed from here 91 trials, repeated. So that's 20 seconds, 60-second interval between each trial. And what you observe is that systematically the response profile of a given mitral cell, a projection neuron, always has this temporal structure. For example, this one will have an excitation that's delayed relative to the onset of the stimulus, which is the gray zone here. First burst inhibition, and then a second burst. This cell will be inhibited there, excited later. This one will be strongly inhibited there, excited later. This one has a very different profile from that one. So over the population, you will activate a large number of cells, in fact, a very large proportion of the neurons that exist. But each one of them will express a particular temporal profile. So all of these cells, in this case, all of these cells are, that's in the locust, and they have projections within several of those glomeruli. So they actually sample information from several glomeruli. But if you do recording from the bee, which only project to a single glomerulus, you also find those temporal profiles. So it doesn't seem to depend on whether those neurons sample one or several glomeruli. It's the analog of the mitral cell. It's the equivalent of... No, the cells, as I said, the glomerulus itself is only a site of projection. There are no cell bodies in it and so on. Yeah.
Does it depend on the behavioral state?
All of these experiments so far have been done in the same behavioral state, which is awake but immobilized. So all those animals are just held, just like, you know, most insect experiments, the animal is held in place and stimulated with an odor at particular times. We're actually now trying to do that in different... Yeah, no, we haven't done any experiments in actively behaving and actively sampling animals, and there will probably be interesting differences under those conditions, yeah. But all of these things are done in awake, so-called animal, yeah. Okay. The oscillations are here. In fact, you don't see them there, but hidden within this, are oscillations in that period. So that's a 1 second period, and you have 20 cycles roughly, so 20 to 30 hertz oscillation in that period of time. Okay? So that's again a summary of what I'm going to say in a minute. What we find is that if two odors are chemically similar and we look at their representations across olfactory receptor neurons, we'll find that they'll overlap greatly between them. There'll be a high degree of correlation between those representations in terms of neural identity, as also a function of time. So over the duration of the response, this overlap will be maintained over the entire duration. However, if now we move to the mitral cells, to the output of that structure, and do the same operation, compare the actual structure of the representation over time, what we find is that this overlap will be reduced as a function of time. And we believe that this overlap reduction, this decorrelation, is a result of this temporal patterning that occurs within that structure, and that occurs thanks to those lateral connections that exist within the circuit. Okay. So this temporal patterning of the response would play the role of decorrelating input representations. In other words, if you have small differences between representations here, what the system does for you using time is to amplify the small differences. Okay.
Is it the
No,
design?
No.
Look like.
In where?
Like the onset in the right, in the output, the onset of the burst is more jittered. Like there's more.
Oh, here?
So
there?
Yeah.
Okay, now I'll show you real data. this is, you take a, this is a schematic. Yeah, this is my hand.
This is Jitter in Illustrator.
Okay, so the computation will be decorrelation, and we'd go now from a spatial representation at that level to a spatial temporal one. We also go to a very dense representation and a very redundant one, because precisely of this high degree of interactivity between all of these different cell types. And the result will be that many different neurons will be activated, so that there will be a high degree of correlation between many different cells.
But I mean, do you test that redundancy issue by going in and doing ablation?
No, not with doing ablation, just by looking at the proportion of cells that are actually responsible and responding to all of these different odorants. So if I'll show you some data later on, if you actually look at if you do a tetrode recording from the antennal lobe and present a given odor, you will find that there is a very large number of the projection neurons that you record from that respond to the odor that you present. Okay. If you move to that structure, and that's what I'll show at the end, what you find is that the proportion of success in finding a cell that responds decreases tremendously. So here, there is something like a 50% chance of finding a responding neuron to a given odor. Here, it's a proportion that goes very, very, very,
so this
very
is part
small.
Of the origin of your statement, decorrelation?
No. That's a different fact. The decorrelation is simply, the statement about the decorrelation is simply to the result of the fact that we observe a decrease in the overlap between representations as a function of time. Over the duration of the response, okay. So it has nothing to do with the fact that there's a compression downstream. It's a separate thing. Okay, that's in fact partly a measure of the redundancy. If this is a set of experiments where in the antenna lobe, we record from one a set of projection neurons, again using tetrodes, and then we're going to present a set of odors. And if, so in this case there's 10 odors, and if we find that a given cell responds to one odor, we look at the conditional probability that that cell responds to the other odors that are in the set. And those odors are in groups of three that belong to the same chemical family, so there'll be three aldehydes and three aromatic phenol-based odors, etc. Okay, and this is the profile that you get across odors. So one odor is one, and you see that you have even at seven, you have a conditional probability of 0.5 of having respond to seven other odors. It's huge. Each cell responds. So that's only a response. It doesn't characterize how this response is. Obviously, they're different across the different odors. But if you find a cell that responds to a given odor, it's very likely that it will respond to many different odors that you happen to have in your apparatus. Okay? And that's something that you will never find when you go down there. And I'll show you the data.
Would it respond more to odors?
Yes, it would, absolutely. But again, if you do that, exactly the same experiment with the same panels of odors downstream, that's again something you won't find. Yeah. So I'll go at the end to that. I'll give you the detail. Okay, so some structure. Maybe I should have given you that first. This is a cross-section of the insect brain, half of it. You see the eye and the beautiful structures that you know well. Here is the antennal lobe, which is the first olfactory relay. This is the same structure now seen in fluorescence, and what you can see, the bright dots here each correspond to different glomeruli. Okay. the axons of these cells in the antenna lobe now project up to the mushroom body here and send collaterals within the mushroom body, and also go beyond it to project in the lateral horn, where they also make excitatory inputs to other cell types. And among those cell types are lateral horn interneurons that are GABAergic that feed forward to the mushroom body also. So the basic structure is that one. You have an antenna lobe with 800 of those cells. Outputs en passant in the mushroom body, and I'll give you the numbers later on. Outputs finally in the lateral horn, and from the lateral horn, a feed forward to the same target cells called Kenyan cells, which is inhibitory. And that basic structure, as you'll see, has a great importance in defining the integration window of the cells. And as a result, those cells will become very fine coincidence detectors.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, it's not feedback. Those cells receive direct. I mean,
these are axons, the black ones, right?
Yeah.
And the green one is axon going back.
It's an axon. Well, it's going back in that drawing. I could draw it in the other side. It looked like it's going forward. No, because it's not. The feedback inhibition would result from these cells feeding back through an inhibition onto themselves and inhibiting themselves. And that's not the case. These cells, I'm looking at it from the point of view of these red cells called the Kenyan cells. Those cells receive direct inhibitory input from these excitatory cells and indirect inhibitory input going through there. And it's feed forward in that sense, not feedback. Okay?
I mean, it's just the obvious question. Is there integration with the output for the olfactory lobe from the optic lobe in the horn?
In the horn, very possibly. There are lots of neurons that do project there, at least send dendrites and axonal endings there. That's clear. Within the mushroom body, yes, there's a lot of visual activity there.
So the animals, can the animals track purely on olfaction? And do they track? Can they track any absence?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, purely on olfaction, no, because in general, when, say, a flying insect is orienting within a plume, it uses mechanosensory information also. It detects wind direction and usually flies upwind and then cast across the plume. So it uses other types of information. Some insects do that in daylight. Some of them do that at night. So in that case, they don't use vision, at least that we know. Okay. I've shown you that. This is so the oscillatory structure. So you asked me where are the oscillations in here. So we're going to zoom in onto, it's actually not the same experiment. We're going to zoom in time on these experiments. And so that these are all experiments that we did with Mike Ware, where you record from, in this case, two projection neurons simultaneously, and the field potential from the target structure, one of the target structure, which is the mushroom body. Okay, so the field potential is an average potential created by the outputs coming together from a population of projection neurons. Okay, and a given order here, apple is presented, and these are 25 trials or so. And what you observe is that if you align all of these trials on the stimulus onset, the probability of firing defines this pattern here, where there's a very nice alignment of spike at that time, which corresponds to the first oscillation cycle, the second, and the third. And if you look at the second neuron, you'll find a very similar pattern. But if you compare the probability of firing in the first cycle in response to apple and in response to that mixture, where you add to apple another odor, what you find is that the probability of firing in that cell now has dropped dramatically. So what happens is that there is, it appears, a very fine temporal patterning of responses whose resolution at least is one oscillation cycle. It doesn't appear to be phased within a given oscillation cycle, but it appears to be whether a cell will fire at a given oscillation cycle. Say again? Yes. From the mushroom body, so from the target structure. It's very difficult to get a field potential from the antenna lobe itself, probably because of its structure and spherical symmetry and so on. So you can get good field potentials, but it's very difficult to find. In the mushroom body, it's a lot easier. It's a more or less layered structure. If you're in the right position, you always get these oscillatory responses.
What's the distance between one glomerule and the
other? It varies from, I don't know, 5 microns to anything on.
Do you think this is, what's the sort of integration size of the LFP?
The LFP is in the structure that's downstream of it, that doesn't have glomeruli.
From how many glomeruli does it
take? I see, I understand what you say. So the field potential is most likely the result of synaptic currents evoked in the intrinsic cells of the mushroom body, the Kenyon cells, by converging projection neurons. Now, the converging the projection neurons themselves have highly divergent projections within the mushroom body. So a given axon will diverge and give lots of collaterals, so that any point within the mushroom body receives collaterals from a very large proportion of the total number of projection neurons. So this LFP, in fact, is very similar from the one that you record half a millimeter away at the other end of the mushroom body. It appears to be extremely homogeneous over the entire structure. So, in fact, even better, if you record the subthreshold activity of a local neuron within the antenna lobe, so the cells that inhibit those guys within the antenna lobe, those cells are extremely, they're non-spiking, they arborize very diffusely across the entire neuropil. Very often, the subthreshold activity of a given local neuron is a carbon copy of the field potential that you record here. So it most likely represents very well the average activity of the population. Almost no feedback, yes, that we know of, definitely. It's if there is any, it's probably through neuromodulatory cells that release serotonin and other things that probably are used in learning, but very little feedback that we know of that's fast and fast enough to modify the output.
So across the mushroom body, are you expect to get the same LFP? I mean, the same LFP across the entire mushroom body?
Yeah. With zero phase lag across the entire structure.
Is it, stimulus locked?
Yes, all of this has been locked to the all these are locked to the stimulus. And that's the only way that we could see that. That's the only way that we could see this difference in fine patterning here. Well, if you can correlate, but all you see is some sort of, if you have enough trials, again, is some, yeah, the side peaks, and the strongest peak in your correlation is moved to a side, that's all. But it doesn't really tell you that there has been this very precise skipping of one cycle by that cell. The cross-correlation would not tell you that. Yeah.
Just wondering, what happens if you give the stimulus for the cherry also and then compare the...
Uh-huh. We have that. The response to cherry was that this cell here did not respond at all. The field potential, the field potentials look very, very similar across orders. We've tried to classify them and so on, and on the basis of the field potential, the envelope. We've never been able to classify orders in a very reliable way. It's probably the average of too much going on. You really need to look at the detail cell by cell to figure out what it is. Yeah?
So is it, do we take, the concentrations are about the same?
Yeah.
Does concentration play into this?
I'll go to it at the end. I'll skip that for now, but maybe at the end I'll go, or later on in the week. It's an interesting aspect. There's, in fact, non-stationarity in the way in which the system deals with concentration. In fact, there's a lot of priming and hysteresis in the system. What we find is that if you go up the concentrations and back down and compare the way in which you respond, the system responds to low concentrations, after having gone through the high concentrations, the low concentration response looks a lot more like the high that preceded it than it does to the low concentration at the very beginning of the experiment. So there's something that tends to force the animal to sort of ignore concentration, at least across a certain subset of neurons.
What about adaptation?
There is adaptation. There is definitely adaptation across. So you can never maintain a stimulus for very long because the receptors adapt. So they'll respond in most cases for a few seconds and then stop. And you need to stop for a while. And you, in many, many cases, 10 seconds is sufficient and then start again. In natural conditions, I'll show you later on experiments that we did in plumes stimuli. So we don't control the stimulus at all. We just make it turbulent. And we have filaments that are, in fact, very variable in duration and in timing. Under those conditions, there's very little adaptation after the first hit. After that, the adaptation, so yeah, but it's I'll go into it in more detail. It's actually much more interesting than that because you have a decrease in overall firing rate in those neurons, but you have an increase in the precision, the temporal precision of the responses at the same time. So when the system is totally naive, these oscillations actually will not occur. So if upon the presentation of an odor in a naive animal, you will have a very strong response from the projection cells, very high firing rates, no oscillatory synchronization, and very rapidly the system adapts, decreases its response, but the spikes become precisely aligned with one another. So this adaptation is in fact more complex and interesting than just a reduction in firing rate. It will be the same. No, it will be naive. Yeah, it will be naive. Exactly. This fast adaptation and learning thing and organization occurs very rapidly within seconds. And if you don't maintain or present the stimulus for a while, it is forgotten within about 10 minutes. Exactly. Here we ignore the first experiment. In fact, when we're doing these experiments, I mean, imagine the way in which you do an experiment in general. As a physiologist, you put your electrode somewhere, you have a neuron, and then you test stimuli until you find one that excites the neuron. But when you do this, you actually train the animal. So you're not in a position in your real experiment, once you've identified the right stimulus, to say that the system has actually changed from its naive position. So you have to be very well aware of that to be able to actually identify this phenomenon, especially because it's so fast to occur. So, in fact, if you repeat odors, if you present many more odors like this and look at the temporal patterning of these same two cells, so these blocks here represent whether there is a high firing probability in a given cell at a given cycle, you'll find different temporal patterns and alignments of spikes in those two cells in response to different odors. So you can imagine that the representation of all of these different odors is in fact carried across the ensemble of neurons and also across time, where time can be binned in oscillation cycles, and each oscillation cycle characterized by a certain combination of projection neurons firing together. Okay, so each odor will evoke a different spatiotemporal pattern that will be characteristic of a given odor. Okay, so that's the summary of the stuff that we did with insects, and we were interested in finding out what advantages these temporal patterning might have, and that's when Rainer Friedrich came to the lab and started working on this problem, but now in zebrafish. So in zebrafish, the odor space is different. The odors are move in water, they're solubilized in water. And relevant odors in zebrafish are amino acids. There are many others, but amino acids are very well known to be attractant odors to fish. And the basic idea was to try and understand what role, if any, that temporal patterning, if it exists in fish also, in fish mitral cells, might have. So the experiments now I'm going to show you are the ones that he did when he was in the lab. So an olfactory object in our experiments will be an amino acid. We use 16 amino acids out of the 20 natural amino acids. That's an example of one. The structure, now you know it. Olfactory receptor neurons, as always, convergence to glomeruli. Mitral cells, the mitral cells in fish receive inputs from a small collection of glomeruli.
Can you just remind us why you chose, why amino acids are in some sense a natural step?
They are the product of decay of other animals or biological products, and that's what the animals feed on. If you go to a fish shop and buy zebrafish or any cyprinid fish food, it will be a mixture of amino acids of various sorts. It's simply their basic food. There are other very attractive and important odors that play pheromonal roles, attractant roles, and so on. Prostaglandins, certain types of prostaglandins play pheromonal roles, and so on. But amino acids are a main part of the relevant odor space for a fish. And in fact, half of the olfactory system is devoted to, apparently, processing information from amino acids. So a given mitral cell will receive inputs from a small collection, about 5 to 10 glomeruli. Then you have lateral connections, as always, mediated by granule cells, projections downstream, and feedback. I'll skip this, and I'll go to the experiments. The experiments were done in an isolated brain preparation, head preparation, where we can present the odor directly to the nasal cavity through the inflow nares, and there is a suction to extract it from it. And we record the activity of mitral cells by intracellular recordings from the mitral cell somata or loose patch recordings from the same somata. Before Rainer came to the lab, he was in Tübingen in Sico and Korsching's lab, and he did a series of imaging studies on the representation of those amino acids, but by the olfactory receptor neurons, so the first neurons in the olfactory pathway. And these experiments consisted in either filling the receptor neurons with a calcium indicator or applying voltage-sensitive dyes to the system. And so this is an image of the olfactory bulb, a portion of the olfactory bulb. And the area that you see in green is the area that responds to amino acid. That's called the lateral band. So all the experiments, the imaging experiments, are going to be done in that structure. That structure and that image here doesn't show the glomerular structure. So these are the amino acids that were used. And these are some raw images of those glomeruli up there. And these are the processed images in response to two of those 16 amino acids that were used. And so you can see that each amino acid will activate a subset of the glomeruli that exist. And there's about 120 or so in that amino acid region.
What are we looking at? Are we looking at presynaptic signals?
So you're looking here at calcium signal from the axonal terminals of the receptor neuron. So you're looking at a presynaptic signal.
Because you loaded the receptors?
Because the receptors were loaded from the nasal cavity by cutting the cilia of the olfactory receptor neurons, loading the receptors, and then letting the dye diffuse for a couple of days and repair and reform their cilia, and then olfactory stimulation of those receptor neurons. So, yeah. Yes.
And it's generally true that one amino acid will activate neighboring.
So that's the slide. So that's more or less the entire, it's not the all of the entire region, but it's a large proportion of it. And this is the patterns that you get, averaged over 2 seconds for all of those amino acids. So on average, a given amino acid will activate about 30 glomeruli, or regions that one estimates are glomeruli, okay? And that number varies from 10 to about 60.
So okay. Arginine and lysine both have one or two amino terminals. That's why you think there's similarity. We're looking at the chart group.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a very good observation. You already see patterns of similarity across them. I think I focus, the phenylalanine and tyrosine here, that again are aromatic amino acids that belong to the same chemical family, very similar to one another. And you see again that they overlap greatly. If you look at the patterns here, they overlap greatly, but you have small differences. For example, this glomerular region here is much less active in this case than it is in that case, and so on. And so what was found by Rainer and Sigrun in those experiments was that if you compare the spatial patterns activated by these different odors across all odors, you have degrees of similarities that depend on the chemical similarity of, between the odors. So if you measure, you had a question? Yeah, that's an average over the 2 seconds of the response. So here time is eliminated. But we redid, I'll show you later on, we redid these experiments with physiology to put time into account. And in fact, this overlap here is maintained throughout the response.
So the topography doesn't seem that strong.
It's not obvious. There is nothing obvious in it. That's, I agree with you. I mean, it's difficult to say that. Not local, yeah. I mean, it's totally consistent with that. I agree with that, yes. I mean, remember that all of the imaging that's done in mammals, and there's a lot of very nice imaging that's been done recently, is always on a very small fraction of the bulb. It only images about 10% of the entire volume of the bulb. So you're looking at, you know, a portion of, but not what really happens.
It's just a technical statement that...
It's a huge structure. It's a spherical, and a lot of it is hidden. And yeah, it's essentially impossible to do it all. So if you measure here the correlation between the spatial patterns evoked by those 16 odors, so that's a simple correlation matrix, and order the odors so as to maximize the number of clusters, what you find is that you have sets of clusters. And those clusters correspond to odors that are chemically very similar. Okay, so aromatic amino acids will evoke patterns that have a great deal of overlap between them. Acidic, same thing. Basic, same thing, etc. That's the same thing after PCAs, just to show. So the first three principal components, and you see these main clusters of odor representation. So this represents the spatial aspect of those representations across the bulb.
This is PCA by taking the spatial pattern and turning it into a vector.
Yeah,
and then
exactly. So across the receptors, the representations are combinatorial. They're chemotopic in the sense that there is high similarity between like odors, between the representations of like odors. But it's unclear that there is particular regions that correspond to particular chemical structures, and there are clusters, clusters of like representations that correspond to the chemical groupings. So now, when Rainer came to the lab, the question was to try and apply that, redo this, but now redo it with the postsynaptic target, the mitral cells, and take time into account. You had a question?
No. It's very pretty.
Okay. Oh, thank you. So, I mean, that's the Rainer stained that cell. It's a stain with Lucifer. You see the soma, and you can kind of distinguish the kind of dendritic, small dendritic compartments that would correspond to glomeruli. That's the axon. You tell me. I'm happy to continue. So whatever you want. Okay. If you want a break, we break.
Misha wants a break.
Okay. That's good. No, that's okay. Okay. Sure.
This is much more bushier than the picture than like typical mammalian cell, or is this?
It projects to more than one glomerulus. Five to eight or something like this. But that's very similar to what the tufted cells do in mammals. And the tufted cells are many, many more than the mitral cells. So, and they usually ignore it also.
So
a lot of them will feed back either to the other side or feed back onto the same olfactory. That's for the vertebrate olfactory bulb.
Okay.
So we're talking about the bulb now.
The
tufted cells are in the bulb. They would be equivalent to the mitral cells, except that they often have a different set of targets downstream.
So they receive the input from the
glomeruli.
Yes, from the glomeruli.
Downstream. That's right.
the adaptation that you talked about.
Yes.
It takes like 10 minutes.
Yes, yes.
So it's like when you test wine and stuff, so you like have a small taste and have a small smell, and
yeah.
then you have to wait till you go to the next one, right? I mean,
yes.
assumption. But if the odor is not taken away, so there's like a complete adaptation for the whole period of the odor when it's present, like my the most trivial example is when I put aftershave on myself, mm-hmm. I smell it for the first few minutes,
yeah.
and then I don't
you don't smell it,
anymore,
yeah, yeah.
But it's there.
Yeah.
So this is because of the
adaptation. It's because of the adaptation.
In the nose or in the percept?
Probably all of these. Probably all of these. So you can probably show that it's you can show that it's partly due to adaptation of the receptors, because if, for example, now I test your ability to perceive an odor that's similar to your aftershave and mm-hmm. so on, your ability will probably be impaired.
Okay.
So it implies that some of the receptors involved in this...
This is because of the saturation of the receptors by the molecules?
Yes, most likely.
So
and some biochemical modulation of activity of those cells that might be, you know, mediated by second messengers, and not necessarily by occupancy of the receptor by the ligand, but also you know, very slow processes that have been set up by the machinery.
Okay. So and another question is, like, in dogs, like
yeah.
their percept of the world is much more stronger for the odors than ours. This is because of what? They have
more receptors, many more receptors first.
And many types of receptors?
Their receptors haven't been cloned. I think people are working on that, and we don't know if they have a bigger family. But they also have lower thresholds, so they have a higher sensitivity, and they can respond to concentrations that are thousands of what we respond to. And in fact, in when I said that there's, you know, 1,000 genes in mice, that's true. We have in our genome close to 1,000 genes, but we only express about 200 of them, we as humans. So most of them are what's called pseudogenes, and they're never expressed. So presumably animals that rely very much on olfaction have maintained expression of the entire set.
Because it's like you have, like I have as a human, say about few hundreds of receptor types. But in our eye, I only have
four.
Like for the three colors.
Yeah, three colors in a rod. Yeah. Yeah.
And but my perception of the visual world is much higher than the perception of the olfactory world.
Yes.
Now, is this because of higher brain processes, or
well, I mean,
there are more cells in the retina, and it's the lateral connectivity and the ability to detect movement and all that things.
The problems are different. I mean, in case of olfaction, you don't really have a problem with. You're not. Your goal is not to resolve space or spatial organization, which the visual system wants to do.
But the dogs do have this kind of thing.
Well, so that's a second order a problem, that, which is to detect gradients of concentrations and
exactly.
things like this, which you probably do with temporal integration, comparing successive sniffs and that kind of stuff.
Oh.
So that's probably a higher processing kind of operation.
So our perceptions of the olfactory is more passive?
Like
what makes a difference?
Well, I think it's basically a problem of building receptors. In the case of photons, you're simply slightly shifting the spectral sensitivity of your receptors, and you make them overlapping, and you cover most of the visible range, and which is pretty narrow, and so that's fine. But in the case of olfaction, you're dealing with a chemical world with a very, very wide variety of stimuli, right? You have all sorts of chemical groups, combinations of groups, length of molecules, and so on. And I think it'd be very difficult with a very small number of primitives to gather all of that, right? I think that's probably the reason why there are so many receptor types.
And I have another, like, if this is your break and you want to take a break.
No, go ahead.
I read somewhere where there are like experiments done that many of the inter-human relations, or like animals, and like how dog smells you and they can feel you by your smell, and
yeah.
It also happens in inter-human relations, but it happens on a more subconscious level.
Yeah, possibly.
Like we live, as you said, in a chemical world.
Yes.
Like in the air now, there are hundreds of molecules that I might percept on the subconscious level, but I'm not aware of. And this is why. I mean, the question is, does the processes never reach the higher level function of understanding? Like that I have this smell now, or did we lose this ability?
Because
the visual system is so strong, so we don't pay attention. Or
there is a lot of debate about whether we actually use, as humans, we use pheromones, and it's unclear that we do. For example, the vomeronasal system, which is the one that is supposed to be used for pheromones in other mammals, exists during development, human development, but during late phase development, it disappears. So in most humans...
How late is late?
In a year late...
4 or 5 years of age?
Oh, no, before birth. It's a vestigial, and evolution has clearly decided not to keep it, so our life doesn't appear to depend much on it. But it's not true for all humans. There are some humans in which there is a little pit in the nasal cavity that appears to have still vomeronasal function. So it might very well vary across individuals, and some might be...
Have you read the book Air Perfume by Patrick Ziskin?
Oh, perfume. Yes, I've read it. Yes, absolutely. But this is a novel. This is this guy is amazing. But
the notion of like that you can have this smell of hate and smell of love.
That's fiction, I think.
And do they exist on the subconscious level? Of course, the percept of, let's say, of someone, friends of someone.
Yeah.
So the percept of the person could be also be built up of some odors and chemicals that you don't aware of, but they are there. I mean, like the familiarity of a place also comes in the odor of the place.
Yeah.
You have your own personal smell that you are.
Sure. I honestly, not much is known about.
I ask you like a lot of questions that I like know and see in all those Discovery Channel, you know, and that stuff.
No. It's a very interesting aspect indeed. The kind of subconscious side of olfaction, and like all of these questions, they're very difficult to address, right? First, you cannot really do experiments with animals because you don't quite know what is conscious and unconscious. So you have to deal with humans, and with humans, pheromonal signals appear to be not terribly important. I mean, most people who work with it actually don't believe much in human pheromones.
Industry that are built on that.
Oh, sure, but you know, lots of industries are built on fiction, right?
Okay.
So I think that's not necessarily a good argument, but you're right. I mean, there are lots of perfumery makers that will sell or want to sell a perfume on the basis of its attractiveness.
This is very good.
Thanks.
All right, thanks.
My pleasure.
I was going to ask you about the thing that always fascinated me about the system is this issue of if you give a mixture of odors, that if it is 5 or 6,
yes,
it becomes a single.
Yes.
I guess it raises some issues about is that the right thing to do? In this, is that reflecting some sort of properties of naturally occurring odors?
I presume. So, I mean, yeah, you have this, or you have the other extreme, which is the segmentation, a gas chromatography on your odors, and
right.
determine what all the components are and what ratios and concentrations. That doesn't appear to be at all what the olfactory system has done.
Do you think of that as some sort of temporal patterning?
Is each fraction of time a chemical fragment, or?
I guess is there an issue of sort of these odors come together and create a certain temporal pattern?
Yes.
And the system can't support more than three or four temporal patterns at the same time?
Yeah.
Is there like some large repertoire of temporal patterns it could generate?
Yes.
But at any given time, the interactions among the units are such that it can only support three or four simultaneous temporal patterns.
I think I see where you're going. So you're saying, suppose that the olfactory system's goal had been to segment rather than merge.
Right.
Can we think of a reason why it would not have been able to do it? And you're saying that there is a finite capacity to a system of
Or alternatively, you could say, what is the mechanism for the merging? That'd be another way to say it.
So the mechanism for the merging, I think, is this merging of activity into a temporal pattern. So in a sense, you're all the different elements that come into the picture, or the smell in this case, will influence in a very specific way what goes on in the rest of the circuit. So in a sense, you're making a mitral cell that might respond to component X respond to X in the context of all the others, and through these interactions form something that is unique, but unique for the combination.
Yeah, so it's maybe a way of restating those together. Is there a restricted dimensionality
to this? Yes. But you mean in principle or in practice? Because in practice there probably is, because of this convergence and this bottleneck in that structure. And as I'll show you hopefully at the end, there is in the target structure a massive compression of those representations into a very, very small number of cells. And this in itself would appear to me to be a big problem if you wanted to keep the segmented representations of the components. So what you probably want to do, what the system appears to do is rather optimize the representations by doing this decorrelation, so make the representation of the combination unique and then compress that. And the compression itself, I think, would pose a problem if you wanted to keep the information about all components. But in principle, I'm not sure that there is a real reason.
It's just always interesting because it's so different than I think about vision.
Yeah.
I think about color vision. You generate the perception of being in a very high dimensional space. Okay,
yes.
Not,
yeah, exactly.
But you generate the sense.
Uh huh.
You're sensing a continuum of color.
Yes. Yes.
It's like the system is doing almost exactly the opposite.
Uh-huh.
Same thing about kind of tracking multiple objects in some scene.
Here it seems to be easier because it's essentially a spatial problem. So if you're, multiple objects in a scene, provided they're in different positions, the problem is solved.
Right.
By itself, but given that there is no space to play with in olfaction, I think that may be a big problem.
Yeah, it's just interesting thinking about the other issue that you've got in olfaction is the dimensionality. So you don't have space as an input, but the dimensionality of your odor space.
Yes.
Whereas in vision,
yeah, it's restricted. Yeah.
More restricted coming in. And it's kind of interesting to think about how that influences.
No, I mean, you don't want to handle
the
signal and whether that's in part an explanation for why the system works.
I'm sure, in great part. Yeah, one, the stimuli are very different, and two, what the animal wants to do with them is probably also very different. So, but there's other, the what's called the hedonic aspect of olfactional, so it's really interesting. You know, usually attach a valence, attractiveness or repulsiveness to a given odor. So where's that put in?
Yes, you know, people will migrate.
Okay.
If we don't stop, they'll never migrate.
So, as I told you, that the mitral cells, just like the projection neurons in insects, will respond to odors.
Can I ask just a question? You started on insects, and now we're moving to
fish, and we'll go back to insects.
So, why did you do this?
Why? Why didn't I do everything on insects? You know, that's if I could control everything that I do, that, but the fish. No, that has nothing to do with funding.
Are there things that were special about working on the zebra fish?
Yeah, I mean, one is that Rainer had characterized the representations of these odors in the across the receptor neurons.
There's
this background which we don't have in insects. And so that was a very strong foundation to work on, and that was basically the reason we decided to continue on fish. Although it's another system, it's actually simpler than the and smaller than the insect. It has less cells. It's smaller physically. It's in many ways a simpler system than the insect system.
You want to ask whether it has also spatial temporal
code? Well, that's the part of the answer.
So the fish you showed was a pregnant female, and does that bear on the kind of results you
get? No. All of the results are done from juveniles and young adults of either sex, and it won't make any difference.
Did the fact that the odors are spread through the water, does it make it a big difference, right, in terms of that?
There's a difference in the dynamics, but overall the stimuli that we use for all these experiments were very well controlled. In puffs of odorized air, where the odor has been mixed in the water that's going to be puffed onto the nares, and it's odor.
If you take an odor with, let's say, one of your amino acids, and you put it in water, you get the same response.
Yes.
As if you were to put it in air.
No. I mean, they don't smell in air, so it's not even an issue.
No, of course not. But the comparison between species is not very well founded. Unless have you used the same odors in the insects as well?
Well, no. They won't. Those odors are not volatile in those concentrations. Not volatile in air. So you won't smell them. Well, no, you don't make comparison per.
The first one hydrophobic.
It's a different system. You've got different receptor types, different odor and receptor genes and molecules and receptor types. You have different odorants in those systems, but the basic principles appear to be the same. And that's what I'm going to get at, right? I don't think it matters very much. I agree with you. The dynamics are different because of the fact that it's water in water. But in fact, in the end, it becomes it's very, very similar. So your question was: is there the same kind of flavor to the representation?
Why go to
the fish?
Only in
local. Yeah. No, that's. I mean, that could be part of the answer. Sure. And so, that's an example of three mitral cells recorded in the same animal in response to the same odor, which is this mixture of arginine and lysine here. And you can see that each one of them responds differently to the same odor. Okay. You can also see some of the things that I'll develop later on, which is this subthreshold stuff here, which corresponds to oscillatory synchronization. Yes, well, the field potential we get through other methods, so we can record from those cells also with loose patch, and the loose patch has the advantage that in addition to the spike train, we don't get the subthreshold stuff anymore, but we can get the field potential in the vicinity of the cell body. So we get the local field potential in the neighborhood of the cell whose spikes we record from. So in that case, we get those nice field potentials, which again give us high power in the 20 hertz band. Again, same thing.
It's a glass pipette?
Yeah, it's a glass pipe. It's a patch pipette.
That's near to the cell body?
Yeah. So you apply it, and you apply it right to the cell body. You apply very gentle suction. It's about a micron.
And do you get the field potential?
Yeah. 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 What you have to do is to apply the suction just right. You must not rupture the patch, and you must not apply too strong a suction. And so by doing this, you can get very good recordings, both in the field and the intra. The spike output. So, yeah, the field would be local and would represent, you know, I mean, it's hard to know, but what goes on in that neighborhood, maybe 10 to 100 cells, it's hard to know, right? So that's an example here of a recording just to show that the phase of the spikes relative to the field potential is not dependent on the odor. So what you see here is the cell, the spikes and the field recorded simultaneously. And here the phase of each one of these spikes in relation to the corresponding oscillation cycles in response to those three odors. And you can see that in each case it's the same phase. So there doesn't appear to be a phase encoding in the system, just like in insects.
Is the phase between what and what again?
The spike and the corresponding oscillation cycle in each case, so you do it over all spikes. Yeah, you could that would give us the same thing. Yeah, absolutely. But there's an interesting observation, which is that in that system, the onset of the oscillatory synchronization is actually delayed relative to the onset of responses across the population. So that's an example, and that's an average over many cells. And the example shows you the duration of the odor pulse, which is this green box. The top is a given mitral cell, and below is the field potential. And you can see that there is a period of time here where some mitral cells at least respond, they in fact respond very vigorously, during which there is no yet oscillatory coherence. And if you do it over all experiments, all odors, etc., an average of all of them, what you find is the same thing. There is here the average firing rate over the population of mitral cells, which follows the odor onset immediately, goes up, and there's about a half second, a 400 millisecond delay between that and the growth. In this case, what's plotted is the power, the oscillatory power in the 20 hertz band between those two phenomena. So you have an early period of the response across the population where many cells fire, but they're not synchronized with one another. And as the response is prolonged, then the system self-organizes and gets oscillatory, and the field now reflects this.
So okay. You take this as maybe evidence that the inhibitory neurons are not forming an oscillatory network because you might have thought that would be running in the background?
We don't know why there is that delay. We just don't know. It could be that the system needs some time. It could be that because of this very sharp and rapid increase, very high firing rates, the system is not able to get in that stable oscillatory regime yet, and it needs some very quick adaptation to enter that regime. We just don't know. It's just an observation, but you'll see that. Yeah, no, the oscillatory, but there's plenty of time here for that feedback to establish this. So it could very well, like in insects, it occurs immediately. You don't need to wait several hundred milliseconds for the system to oscillate. It oscillates as soon as you can detect a response. So clearly there's something different here And in fact, you'll see that it's interesting because the way in which the representation, the other representations is in that period here is different from what it is later on when the system is oscillate.
Earlier, the system adapts so that if you were to give another, in the index at least, another order, say 2 seconds later or 3 seconds later, you're not going to get the same degree of activation.
Mm-hmm.
Would you get faster coherence in terms of oscillation?
Yes, I mean, it's a good point. In all of the experiments that we have and that we show here, we eliminate the first trial. So it's the same thing. It would be the same thing in the fish also. We just don't take the first trial that shows this this lack of oscillatory synchronization. In fact, if the pulses are longer than this, towards the end of the pulse, you will see the system start oscillating. But we just don't put them in here because it adds complication to that. To the thing. I'll hopefully go back to it later on. So now we're going to go to the basic problem of characterizing the tuning profile of a mitral cell, because we're going to test a given mitral cell across 16 odors, and what we want to try and understand is the way in which they represent those different odors, and then we're going to pool all of these. And here is an illustration of the statement I was making earlier, which is that we don't think it's appropriate to measure and quantify the response of a mitral cell to an odor by a firing rate. And the reason is this, and that's the patterning of the cell in response to different odors. So in this case, you have the same mitral cell in response to two amino acids, and you can see that its response profile is very different from the two. Here it's inhibited first and then excited. Here it's the opposite, it's excited first and inhibited. And although the average rate might be very similar, you would lose all the information that's contained in this temporal patterning. So how to represent this? So that's the typical response profile of one mitral cell. We did that over every single mitral cell, characterized its response to the 16 amino acid. Look at alanine up there. That's one mitral cell, and that's another mitral cell. And you can see that each mitral cell responds to a bunch of different amino acids, in fact, many of them often. But the response profile can be profiles can be very different. So compare these two, this and that, right? You go from one pattern to another, and each mitral cell will have a very specific combination of patterns to those 16 different odors. So the way we decided to try and quantify and show this was to do the following thing. We cut the two-second period of the response in small bins, 100 to 400 milliseconds, and we're going to measure the average rate during that small period of time. So here I'm showing it to you with 100 millisecond bins. And we're going to show here in that first row at the top the firing rate in a color code for each one of the 16 odors. So each pixel here, each square, would represent the response of that cell to each one of the 16 odors. And we're going to order the odors in such a way that the one that gives the strongest response is at the center, and we go down in each direction. Okay? So that represents the tuning profile of that cell over the first 100 milliseconds of the response. And then we're going to scroll that window forward and redo it across the same odors, whose position then will be maintained. And you can see that over time, in this case, the firing profile didn't change terribly much.
The white is the maximum
response. So that would be, okay, the top response across the 16 odors. So now we do it for a bunch of cells, so that's six different cells. And same principle, that's a full second. And you can see here, that the firing profiles, the tuning profiles, actually change over time. So characterizing this as an average would not really mean much. In fact, what you need to do is to characterize the tuning profile at each period of time, and you can say that this cell prefers odor X here, but odor Y 1 second later. So we did that across a set of 50 mitral cells that were fully characterized for all the 16 odors. And so these are all those spatiotemporal or odor temporal patterns and response pattern for those 50 odors. Okay. So now how can we?
Horizontal strips, which means that initially the cell responds
No, no, I'm sorry. This is artifactual. It's just to separate the initial one to the one a second later. Okay, so what you should really look at is the central portion. It's just to allow the comparison between those.
But how variable are these temporal?
I'll show you later, maybe the previous. Well, you can see it here. You can see the various trials.
So.
Yeah, look at the rasters.
So, I mean, but the rasters are three trials.
Yeah, those are three trials. Do you remember the 91 trials I showed you for the insect?
But glycine looks, like, I mean, alanine looks great, and serine looks great. And,
right,
and
well.
Glycine looks a little all over the place. And, how do we say?
You say what you want. This is data. I'm just showing you the data, right? You can say what you want. It's, if you ask me, is there?
As you repeat in many trials, you do kind of jackknife statistic. You come up with a standard deviation.
I mean, if you want, I can. Yeah, sure. If you want a measure of the variability across trials, I'll give that to you. But it's not really important for the question I'm dealing with here. Okay, that's and. Do you remember the slide with the 91 trials I showed you earlier? I'll show it to you later on, and then after that you'll tell me if you think I should measure it and give you a number. I'll be happy to do it. So here is a measure of the correlation between those patterns over the different periods of time. And we do the same thing now for the mitral cells and also for a set of olfactory receptor neurons from which we recorded activity to the same 16 odors in the same way. Okay, so again, we do it with 100 millisecond windows, and we measure the degree of correlation between any one of these 100 millisecond windows and the initial one. So it represents the tuning profile of a given mitral cell and its resemblance as a function of time to the one that it had initially at the onset of the response. And that's across a single odor, averaged over odors, and averaged over mitral cells. Okay. So you can see here there's a massive decrease in correlation over time. So it's a correlation between any one of these horizontal bands and the initial one. Okay? So you measure the degree of correlation between any one of these, which represents the odor tuning of that cell at that time, to it's tuning to those 16 odors at that time. And you average that over all the mitral cells. And that's what the plot shows you. Yes, yes, exactly.
It's the tuning. It's not for each odor. It's across all odors.
It's across odors, exactly. It's across odors. And that is the same thing with across the olfactory receptor neurons across the same period of time. So while the tuning profile of the olfactory receptor neurons maintains a strong correlation with its onset response, its onset tuning over the response over time, you find a very different thing across the mitral cells. And the reason you see this is because there's this temporal patterning that occurs within the olfactory bulb. Okay. While there is this decorrelation between the patterns over time, there is not a sharpening or a broadening, in fact, of tuning of these cells over time. It's not like you start with a certain tuning profile and then you shrink it, which is the thing that you would predict if there was some kind of lateral inhibition and sharpening. Okay. So here we measure this through two different methods. In one case, we measure the half width of what would be the tuning curve if we did it in a conventional way. Here we measure sparseness. And in all cases, it's essentially it's maintained over the duration of the stimulus. So it appears that it's not so much a sharpening of the tuning curves, but it's rather a redistribution across stimuli.
Well, maybe the sharpening happens very rapidly. There could be sharpening for inhibition that happened in the first 100 milliseconds.
Yeah, we haven't gone beyond that that fraction of time. The problem is that within the first 100 milliseconds, you won't have many spikes to do that with. But yeah, it would be worth looking at if with a much higher temporal resolution, we could get something. I mean, you'll get just a few spikes. It'd be very hard to figure it out.
So every bin is 100 milliseconds, right?
Well, we've done it with 100. In this case, it's 400 milliseconds, so it varies.
It sort of stabilizes on a different...
Yes, it will. Well, no, it's...
I mean, if you know the correlation after 1 second.
Yeah.
The same thing after 1 second. Would it be high, yeah, correlation? Between successive bins?
Oh, the correct. So your reference now is what it is there.
Right.
Okay. The correlation will be low. It continues to evolve. It continues to evolve. But overall the decorrelation, there is definitely an asymptote after about 800 milliseconds, but there is not a stabilization of the temporal patterns. Yeah, it keeps changing. Yeah, exactly. But you cannot really push it much longer than 2 seconds because the receptors adapt beyond that. So there is a period of time when...
I'm bothered by the pass to the readout cyclic. I mean, it will have every 100 milliseconds a different code in its input.
Well, so we'll get to that. We'll get to that later. Yeah.
But it would be interesting to see what the correlation would be across tracks. So do you have these cells recorded simultaneously?
No, those cells are not recorded simultaneously. We're doing that in locust at the moment with simultaneous recordings from 20 cells.
The correlation across trials of the same order and high?
Yeah, well, so I have some of those experiments that have been done. Again, they're done across cells taken from different experiments or different, they can be from the same animal but different trials, where we try and look at the correlation. I'll get to them in a few slides, so then I can explain to you how it goes, and hopefully we'll answer that question. Okay. So here is an example of activity across those 50 cells. In fact, only 49 of them are shown, 7 by 7. So each square here now represents one cell, and it represents its firing rate over a 400 millisecond period, and we just scroll that period forward. Okay, and we order the cells in such a way that the one that responds most is in the center, and then we go out towards slower responses. So that would be the ideal spatial pattern that you would see with a camera if those cells were organized in that particular way, right? And now we follow the activity across the population over time. And what you can see is that it's not like this area becomes smaller or moves some way in some coordinated fashion, but there is simply a redistribution of activity across the population.
But sort of the most active guy kind of stays
with that. It will happen for some cells. It will not happen for some odors. It will be different from other odors. Okay. But what you have to look at is the overall population of cells that's active here will change.
And also,
No, it's the same time step. Oh, I see. You mean the time step between, the interval between them there? Yeah. This is plotted here, okay? Yes. So if you want all this, those patterns, so the measures of the correlation between any one of these and the initial one across all of the odors, this is this.
By 2 seconds, the response is going down. So you've renormalized that data to the maximum rate in that time interval?
Not in these plots.
So basically, that's the yellow guy has the same. The third one over in the middle row, the third column over in the middle row has the same firing rate over two second period.
You're saying this guy here. Will be similar to that guy there. Yeah.
That's the same number?
Yeah.
You're
right. It's probably normal. I actually don't remember for that particular slide. Yeah. In here, they actually look normalized because there's always one that's the white here.
It won't affect the normalized correlation, but what it will affect is that by the time you're getting out to these long times, the noise level could be high.
That goes back to this question, and that will be addressed later on. I'll show you later that the variability of the responses at the later parts is in fact less than it is at the earlier parts. So this is not due to an increase in the noise activity.
Okay, but then just give me a hard time.
No, go ahead.
I looked at the first 600 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm. The response is somehow the greatest. It's not changed so very much.
Well,
four guys that are hot.
This. Look at that. Look at that. This is what you should be looking at. This is an example. This is done over the 16 odors. Okay? So look at that. Isn't it going down? Isn't it obvious that it's going down? The correlation between any one of these spatial patterns and the initial one goes down for all odors. So I'll get to that. It is not due to noise, because what we can do, I'll tell you now, what we can do is simply identify the odor that was presented by comparing one trial, the vector that would be constructed from one trial across the 50 cells, to the vectors that are constructed from the same 50 cells at other trials. So we take one template constructed from a single trial, and then we try and identify what odor was presented at another trial for those same 50 cells. And the error rate is less at the end than it is at the beginning. And that's a template at every time bin, with 100 millisecond time bin. Exactly. And I'll show you that plot later on.
But this suggests that, in fact, the information about the order is in the whole temporal
trajectory. Well, if you had to choose, you'd be better off to do it later than earlier. At least later, what you would have is more information about what odor was presented. In fact, what you get by doing it early is an information about what class of odors you're being presented with. You'll see that in a second. That tells you here, I am in an acidic amino acid, but I don't know which one it is. If you go there, it tells you it was aspartic acid. Okay, so for that, if you want to do that problem, classification is better early, identification is better late. That's it.
But the best
would be essentially, if you want to reconstruct everything and have everything you want, it would be to have the trajectory, and that's really what would give you the maximum. Yeah.
So, I mean, one of your comments just there on this earlier paper here about quenching oscillations with the toxins. If I remember from the previous picture, it took about a half a second until the oscillations came on, right between the time you had this initial response to the neuron. So I take it that when I look at this correlation, which is thought of.
Yeah. These
parts of the correlations are non-oscillatory activity, and the later parts are with oscillatory activity.
Well, I mean, all of this is done over scrolling. All these measures of power spectrum and so on are all done over some window of time. So the measures are some average over the window. Okay.
No,
so there
the
is indeed
the dynamics that's going on.
The dynamics, exactly. At the onset, when the dynamics, the oscillatory dynamics at least, are not involved yet, it's clear that, I haven't got there yet, but it's clear that at that time, this process has not taken place yet. But it's clear that when you're in the region of the portion of time when the oscillatory dynamics have appeared, it's very clear that then decorrelation has occurred. Now, whether the oscillation, the coherence, plays a causal role in creating this decorrelation, we don't know. That we don't know. Okay?
The time being is not taken according to the period of the oscillation. So you still, from what you showed earlier, it would seem to me that you should take the mean, which is one period.
Yeah, we could do that. I mean, the problem that, yeah, I agree. That's why we're redoing these experiments now by recording from the cell simultaneously, and that's when we can really we'll be able to do it cleanly. If we do that precisely, because we're going to have to normalize across each, you know, we're going to have to work with normalized time, because then that varies from cycle to cycle and from experiment to experiment. So it's going to be somewhat messy. So we're just going to do it with, you know, an array of cells all recorded together. But you're right, yeah. I mean, that's really what we want to do, is just to see whether that occurs and can be defined cycle by cycle. That would be very nice. Yeah.
At a different level, just understanding what you're not. So the readout, what do you think is the readout, the COVID, the readout that you review? Is it the total spike number, the amount of millisecond bin, or is it the patterning of the oscillation?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. We don't know.
But I mean, you say, you're targeting at the role, the function of this circuit, as if from here to make a decorrelation of the input.
Mm-hmm.
But this decorrelation is expressed in number of spikes per bin.
Mm-hmm.
But previously you showed us that the code, or one code, is this patterning, or like in every cycle,
yeah,
is the cell file or not.
Yeah.
This has nothing to do with this decorrelation.
Well, it could be. That goes back to Misha's question, which could be that we can observe that decorrelation cycle by cycle if we do it, if we can do it cycle by cycle. We'll do it differently. Yeah, yeah, but that's.
So I ask you, what do you think? What is your guess?
So maybe ask it again at the end, because if I reach it, at the very end, I'll tell you how this thing appears to be decoded by the downstream circuits, and maybe we'll make it clearer then. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And if I haven't answered it, then ask it again. Bug me more. Sparseness gone. Okay, so that's now. It's a measure. So imagine now that we have each odor now is represented by a pattern of activation across these 50 mitral cells, right? So we have a 50-dimensional space, each dimension being one mitral cell, and each odor now will be one vector in that space. Okay. So what we want to do is to look at the similarity across representations by these 50 mitral cells. Across all odors. So we're just doing a correlation measure, so we're measuring the angle between those vectors in that space. And we're going to do it here over the initial period of the response, the first 400 milliseconds of the response. Okay? So that's the initial first 400 milliseconds. The only measure we use is the firing rate across those 400 milliseconds. Okay? And what you see is those nice clusters, and those clusters correspond nearly exactly to the ones that we see when we do the same thing with the olfactory receptor neurons. So what that means is that at the onset of the response, the representation across mitral cells appears to be a carbon copy of the input that it receives from the receptor neurons. Okay? But then the temporal patterning occurs. It already occurs within the 400 milliseconds, but it will occur and become more visible as we move forward in time. So because of this patterning, then we're going to move that window of 400 milliseconds and redo that correlation measure across following time bins. And this is the evolution of that correlation matrix as a function of time. And again, it's a measure of the declustering. You can see that those clusters progressively disappear. Okay, so I think the following one is so again, principal components, the first three principal components, the first 400 milliseconds, and then you move on. And you can see how these clusters disappear. Okay. Factor analysis is another way of showing the same thing, but essentially it's always the same. If we measure and quantify the degree of declustering as a function of time, we see that curve, that after about 800, half to 500 to 800 milliseconds, there is no further declustering. So over this initial period of time.
Can you go back to the... Yes, I mean, in fairness, though, if I had this question of noise, I mean, you would have to take trains, I'm not sure what it is, maybe in the absence of stimulation, and you would get sort of a sphere in this space.
Mm-hmm.
Should be the noise limit at various levels of time.
Mm-hmm.
Because you take the background noise and project it onto the principal complex.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so we don't have any sense of what the variability is.
Well, so again, this is always the same thing. I'm going to go directly to it. This is the receptor neuron. So we do the same thing with the receptors, and that's you see the correlation matrix, beginning and onset. These clusters are maintained throughout the duration if you do it with the receptor neurons. So that's, in a way, that should go towards answering your question. It's exactly the same operation done over there. It's, in fact, a slightly smaller subset of neurons. So the clusters are maintained there, but they disappear across the mitral cells. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we could. In fact, Rainer is trying to do that, but it's difficult because optical imaging doesn't give you the right temporal resolution that you need. I mean, if you want to do it both across an ensemble of mitral cells, so you want to have a large set of cells to look at and have a spike time resolution on all of those cells, it's very difficult to do. I'm not sure it's doable, in fact. Single cell resolution over a population of 200 cells? Well, average activity doesn't really tell you anything. So you can't figure out what's input, what's output, what's internal, and so on. So what you want is, you want to know that this signal, this pixel, and this light intensity that you measure here corresponds to one mitral cell and one mitral cell only, and that's a hard problem. So the way you can do it usually is to focus on one pixel and one cell that you know is well identified, and so that you know that the signal you record is in fact a reflection of the output of that cell, which is another hurdle. Very often you'll get an increase in calcium, signal. It doesn't necessarily tell you that that cell has spiked. It may tell you simply that it received an EPSP at that time. So it's a very hard problem to do. So this is a hopefully answers to your questions. It's a measure of the intertrial variability. So it's done for each odor, each cell, etc. And we measure the SD of firing rate over time bins over the duration of the response. Okay, so that's what's shown there. And if anything, it gets more reliable. And then this is a measure of the error rate that we do in the task that I explained to you. So we could take, we form a vector in that 50D space with only one trial, and we try and assign that to a particular odor based on the vectors constructed from different trials. And we measure the error rate as a function of time, and we see this.
So you say, to combine this with the previous, you say a long time, after 1 second, say the representation just jumped from one representation to another, right? It's not stabilized on any representation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do the same file again, it will repeat the same patterns.
Yeah, exactly. So, from trial to trial, you'll have the same overall evolution. So the system will define a trajectory that's a sort of tube in that space that will be used every time. Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
Because you're showing that the intertrial standard deviation is actually decreasing, but also the firing rate.
That's true. The CV would be no. We've done that. We've done that also. No, it's the same effect.
Your presentation stable after repeating the experiment.
Can you?
That experiment. What is the time scale of the experiment? You show all these amino acids within hours.
Yeah, so three trials are presented with 30-second interval between them. Then you wait 60 seconds, and you go to the other amino acids.
And when you return to the first amino acid,
yes.
You get the same representation?
Yes. Yeah, it's stable over time, over the duration of an experiment. Yeah. An experiment takes hours. It's extremely difficult to get a tuning curve over 16 amino acids, several trials per odor. It takes a huge amount of time. So this is an enormous data set. In fact, it's very difficult.
So you do it for 60
odors?
16
odors. Now we do that with 20 odors routinely, yeah. It's very, very long.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
There's a trade-off. Why do so many odors?
So for other experiments, that's what we do. You're right. I mean, if you want to look at variability across trials, then of course, then you would do it. You know, like some experiments, we do 100 trials with one odor. So it's a different set of questions.
Anything for your identifying odors? Does the type of error you make change over time? So if you try to ID an odor early on.
Yeah, we haven't done that. That's an interesting thing. We haven't looked at that. Yeah, we could do that. I mean, presumably. Exactly. I mean, that's the prediction that the errors would be about classes at the onset, and later on they would be random. Yeah. So that's an example, but David doesn't like examples, so I'm going to move on. So the conclusion here is that we believe that these lateral interactions that occur within the bulb lead to a reformatting of the representation. It's pushed, pushed by a constant input that comes from an array of receptor neurons, and then the olfactory bulb and the set of mitral cells through lateral interactions within the bulb then reorganizes the spatial pattern of activity, introducing time and then introducing a specific trajectory in that state space that becomes stimulus specific. Okay, and the advantage of that temporal patterning is that it amplifies the small differences that exist between representations so as to make them more unique, so as to lead to declustering and better occupy that coding space. Okay, that would be the basic conclusion of these observations. The interesting thing also is that by doing this, I mean, when you do pattern recognition, it's basically there's often many different things to solve at the same time. One is to provide a class information, and the other is to provide precise identity. And in effect, this system does both, but it separates them in time. You get class information initially. That's done simply as a result of what the receptor neurons do. Presumably, that's the only thing they can do due to the way in which the... What?
Classification is represented by firing
rates. Well, yeah, by firing rates across the population and across time, yeah.
Not by the oscillatory patterning, but by...
Here, I'm not talking at all about the oscillatory patterning, okay? I'm only talking about the slow patterning that occurs on top of these oscillations, okay? And then later on in the presentation, in the response, then you get precise information, but you lose information about class. Right, so if the brain and the downstream circuits want to keep both information, presumably those two things have to be encoded separately and then combine in some at some later stage if needed.
Was this tested psychophysically?
No, there is no psychophysychics. We looked in the human olfactory psychophysics literature for things like this, and it hasn't been done. And it's not easy to do. When we started thinking... Well, it's a lot more. When you start thinking about doing it, it becomes a lot more difficult. We talked with Shin Shimojo about doing experiments like this, and we quickly realized. Yeah, but controlling a stimulus well enough that you're going to do that well, especially in an animal like us that breathes and that controls the actual odor delivery, it's extremely difficult. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It could be in the pipeline. You're absolutely right. It's a very, very difficult thing.
It's a long time, you know.
We're not, that's right. Yeah, well, you can come. Do a sabbatical in my lab. That'll be wonderful. It's just we thought about that. That's not trivial either. It's probably a lot more difficult. okay, so now I'm going to go back to the locus. Do you still want to go back, continue or not? Yeah. I can try and finish by 12:30, and then...
Why don't you just make a deal that at some point you had some major conclusions, you just jump, right? Like at 12:20, you just jump to your main conclusion.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to show you the data to support that, but I will try, okay? Whichever. Yeah, I'll be here tomorrow and most of Friday also, so I'll be very happy to continue.
How much more material do you have?
I certainly have enough for a half an hour, so I can.
A lot more we can have in.
I can do half an hour, and then wherever I get, we stop.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
Yeah? Okay. So now I'm going back to the locus system, and everything that I talked about so far, which was in the bulb of the fish, would occur in the antenna lobe of the locus, which is this structure here. Okay. So in the fish. The output of that region of the olfactory bulb probably contains no more than 200 mitral cells. So the entire representation of these odors, which we studied across 50 mitral cells, is probably very representative of what really happens. In the locus, there's more output neurons, there's 800 of them, And as I said earlier, the representation also has that temporal flavor. So it's across, for a given cell, a given odor will evoke a specific temporal pattern. Across for the same cell, but for a different odor, you'll get a different temporal pattern. And it will be the same thing for all cells, okay? So different cells will respond to the same odor with different temporal patterns. So again, across the population, you get a specific trajectory across that space. Superimposed on that slow temporal patterning, which to see it evolves over hundreds of milliseconds, superimposed on that is this fast patterning that's oscillatory and coherent and synchronous, okay? So that you can define, using the field potential, temporal windows during which you can say that there's a high firing probability in a given cell, okay? Now, it's more complicated than this, and I'm not going to go into it, but a given cell will not always fire in synchrony with the field all of its spikes during a response. In fact, for a given odor, there's usually a period of time during which it's tightly synchronized and a period of time during which it's not, okay? So over the population, you will have spikes that you can read off all cells, but of all the spikes that you can see within a 50 millisecond window that corresponds to an oscillation cycle, you will have only a fraction that are tightly synchronized. Okay? And that fraction will come from a subcell population that changes over time. Okay? So,
if you compare how many synchronized versus desynchronized spikes each cell emits, what would be
the... We've never really measured that. It could be half and half. It's a ballpark figure. What you can always define is the period of time, say a period of 300 milliseconds, during which you're sure that cell will be well locked. And then the other spikes will occur, but not be locked.
But your idea is somehow your reasoning is that only when the cell is synchronized, there is information about the order.
We don't know, but that's what we're going to address here. That's exactly what we're going to address here. And the way we're going to address it is by looking at the cells that see those inputs. And those are the target cells. And we're going to address the question of whether they care about the phase of those spikes, whether they care about synchronous spikes or asynchronous spikes, and why.
Well, I guess you could address it on even on the level of the cells, just by looking at whether synchronized firing is more selective in the order.
Well, you could do it, but that's not really the answer that you want, right? It's essentially how you could get the information, ideally. But I'm much more interested in seeing what the system does with that. And that would give us an answer as to possibly why the oscillations exist. Okay.
How do you define a synchronized spike and synchronized
trial? On a single trial, you cannot really do it. So you have to do it across. Sorry?
The readout cyclic should do it.
Sure. I mean, if it happens that cell is within the right window, it will be contained.
If the decoding is based on selecting only the synchronized spike,
mm-hmm.
How can you do it?
Well, it does know that it's synchronized. It just happens to be at the right time, so it is synchronized. It might be spurious.
Temporal window along the cycle in which it will read.
That's right.
If there is a spike there, it will consider it.
That's exactly right. So the population will tell it that's the right time window during which you should see it. So
some processing clock at the window.
Well, that's exactly what I'm going to show you here. That's exactly what it is. Okay, so now I just want to give you an idea of what the circuit is so that we can go into it. Okay, so there's 800 of those axons here that leave the antenna lobe. They then diverge into the mushroom body, the input region of the mushroom body called the calyx, and they send these output axonal collaterals here, which are varicose and make a very large number of outputs. They make 600, on average, 600 outputs. Okay. They contact there and make excitatory connections onto the Kenyan cells, which are these cells in the mushroom body. There's 50,000 of them. They're spiny neurons. They're absolutely tiny. Their cell bodies are about 6 microns. Their processes are about 100 nanometers in diameter. They're very, very small neurons, very high input resistance. And each one of them sends an axon, and then it terminates in 2 lobes, and I'm not going to go into the outputs. In addition to this set of distributed output in the mushroom body, the projection neurons send an axon in this lateral horn, and then there contact a large number of different cells, among which is a subpopulation of, we're trying to count how many there are, but there might be 30 or so, of lateral whole neurons that feed an axon back, physically, if you will, to the calyx. And these axons will make contact again to the Kenyan cells, and those will be inhibitory. Okay, so I'll show you pictures of that later. Sure. Yes. Oh no, that doesn't go to the antenna lobe. That goes to two output regions of the mushroom body that's separate from the antenna lobe. Because, yeah, no. That's
a lateral connection within the mushroom body area.
Are there lateral connections?
This is some other area.
The lateral horn here?
No, the dendrite going back.
No, that's the axon. That's the axon. That's the output of the Kenyan cell. So that's the axon. And these are two axonal branches that terminate into two different lobes. Okay? So these are two outputs. In fact, some of the outputs feed back onto the mushroom body, but I'm not going to talk about that. We know very little about that. What we know about now, though, is this subset of cells that feed back. And I'll show you in a minute what they do. No, to the mushroom body, from the output of the mushroom body to the input.
So in insects there's no feedback, but in
vertebrates there is feedback.
Feedback.
In vertebrates there is massive feedback to the antenna lobe. Yeah. It's probably very, very important in determining the state of an animal. I mean, we know from experiments we've done in rats, for example, that the way in which a mitral cell will respond to an odor depends on what the animal knows what to expect about this odor and the significance that it's come to embody. So if a given odor predicts a reward, or if it predicts a punishment, the kind of firing that you'll get will vary tremendously. So there is this level of complication in mammals, at least, that we have to worry about. But luckily, in those systems, we don't. So we've done those experiments also by cutting that feedback, and the temporal patterns remain in the mitral cells. We haven't done the entire set of experiments with feedback severed, but at least the substrate for the decorrelation, which is this temporal patterning, doesn't depend on the feedback. So we suspect that it's at least in great part dependent purely on what happens within the bulb and not dependent on the feedback. But it's something to take into account at some point. Yeah. So the output, the divergence from one PN to Kenyan cells is about 600. I'm not going to give you the details. So we don't have time. About 600, one PN to 600 Kenyan cells. The convergence to a Kenyan cell is more difficult to estimate, but we can do this by recording intracellularly from a given Kenyan cell and then stimulating the axonal bundle from the antenna lobe from a very low intensity by increasing it periodically, step by step. And by doing it and holding the postsynaptic cell very hyperpolarized, we can detect the number of increasing levels that we can detect. And we can always see at least 20 different increments in PSP amplitudes before we can reach threshold for a cell that's very highly hyperpolarized. So at least it's something between 10 and 20 projection neurons converging onto a given Kenyan cell. That's an average measure. It might vary from cell to cell. Okay. So we're going to assume, because we just don't know if it is so, but because of the fact that the projection neurons send collaterals that are distributed throughout the entire system, of output cells, that each Kenyan cell receives a set of inputs from 20 random projection neurons, okay, coming from the antenna lobe. So by virtue of this connectivity, you could imagine that each Kenyan cell could become the detector for a particular subset of synchronized projection neurons. Okay, and I'm telling you that because I'm going to show you that that's probably the case. Okay. So, first thing, the Kenyan cells themselves have dendritic nonlinearities that make them very suitable to detect coincidence of inputs. We can record from their cell body and have a very good idea of their sub-threshold activity in response to projection neurons. And so that's a set of traces that show you the sub-threshold activity in response to a very low-intensity stimulus across projection neurons. When you increase the stimulus intensity, what you observe riding on top of this EPSP is this active phenomenon here, which is not a spike, but which is an amplified EPSP that's created by calcium and potassium-dependent conductances. Okay, so it's TTX resistance, or most likely created caused by those two different types of conductances. The important fact about this is that you can see this massive amplification of the postsynaptic response, and you can see also the massive increase in the speed of repolarization, that is a decrease in the time constant of the cell. So the integration window when the cell is receiving is hyperpolarized and receives very few inputs is long, but as the cell receives more and more inputs, its integration window shrinks.
This is recording from the soma or the dendrite?
This is recording from the soma. The dendrite is impossible.
And you're blocking
sodium? No, nothing is blocked here. It's all sub-threshold. And so we just here increase progressively the stimulus intensity one notch further, and what you get is a very, very sharp EPSP. You see this very sharp waveform here, with a slight undershoot here, which represents most likely a potassium current. And then, if you reach threshold, then you'll get a full-blown action potential.
So why would the calcium spike go away? It's so narrow now.
There's a potassium. Yeah, there's an active repolarization, very clear. So you get an amplification and also an amplification in the speed of the repolarization. You get a narrowing down of this integration window. So the more inputs the cell receives and more depolarized it becomes, the narrower its integration window becomes.
But it already will narrow a little bit because you're increasing conductances and R is going down, so tau is going down. If you think there's more to it, like you're exciting an active current?
Yes, you are. I mean, it's very clear that all those phenomena here are active phenomena because they're voltage dependent. If you hold the cell, if you hold the cell at a given potential to get this active component and then provide the same input but by holding the cell 20 millivolts more negative, it disappears. All these phenomena are active. Okay, they're not due simply to an increase in conductance due to the synaptic inputs. So, of course, the more inputs you get, the greater the input conductance of the postsynaptic cell is going to be, but it's not sufficient to explain what we see. And so you can see it here. You can see that the change in time constant of the cell just by looking at spontaneous synaptic activity in that cell that simply held at different holding potentials. And look at the speed of repolarization of these EPSPs as a function of holding potentials. So the basic thing here is that the more the cell is depolarized, the shorter its integration time constant is going to be, and that's going to be important. Another feed-forward inhibition. So we're going to look now at those cells. So we're going to record from those lateral horn interneurons, present odors to the animal, and see how they respond. The prediction is that they should oscillate because they will receive input from the mass of projection neurons there. So I think first is a projection pattern. So that's the axonal pattern of projection from one of those lateral horn neurons, the green curve here. It overlaps and projects to the entire calyx of the mushroom body, so they diverge to most of the volume of the circuit. And this is a set of responses from two of those cells, one here and the other there, and the field potential from the Martian body recorded simultaneously. Look at these very clear oscillation patterns that you get in those cells that are perfectly locked to the field potential.
You really don't think this is due to like activation NMDA or something, as opposed to turning on of a low threshold calcium?
No, there's no NMDA receptor known in insects. No, it's a... Yes. I mean, you can block it with strontium, but there are lots of experiments that we need to do to characterize them by physically, which we haven't done. It's the most parsimonious explanation. We know from patch clamp recording in vitro that those cells express calcium, voltage-dependent calcium currents and voltage-dependent and calcium-dependent potassium currents. So it's it seems like the obvious explanation. So the other important aspect about those cells, in addition to the fact that they oscillate in response to odors, is that their responses are highly unspecific. And that's an example of one of these cells, one of the two I showed you earlier, and that's to an array of different odors here. And they will respond with essentially the same temporal patterning to all of these odors, which implies that most likely, because simply of the convergence that that occurs between a very large number of PNs and a rather small number of lateral horn neurons, that they receive inputs from a very large fraction of those projection neurons. They sort of average the population activity. Okay, so all the temporal detail that you get from an individual projection neuron is drowned out by the temporal detail of all the other projection neurons that happen to converge in that same cell. So, are they locked? Same thing. Now we just look at a cross correlation between that trace and that trace, and that's what you see here. So you can see.
Parsimonious choice. If you go back to the previous choice, hexanol was the only one that was different.
Yeah. So what?
I mean, what you're showing me in the what you're showing us in the next slide is that what? I mean
when you look at at biological data, you always find an example that doesn't fit the description of the average.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'd like to see cherry, not because of any particular flavor.
Oh, what is it? So this is the bad example? Ah, I see what you mean. And so you think that, in fact, the cell whose response I showed you, the cell here is the one, is the one at the top. Okay? The cross-correlation is from the cell at the bottom. Okay? So don't try and match this pattern with the previous slide. It's a different cell. Okay? So you're looking here simply at the cross-correlation between those two traces. And you can see that they're precisely locked. So time goes up the axis. It's a sliding cross-correlation. Time goes up this y-axis. And you can see the very tight locking that remains during the presentation. But the interesting thing is that the timing of the spikes of the lateral horn neurons is phase delayed relative to the timing of the projection neuron spikes. So if you look at it from the point of view of a Kenyan cell, the Kenyan cell will receive first a volley of inputs that comes from a specific array of projection neurons that will depolarize it. And so you would predict that at each cycle of this oscillation during another response, the voltage of the Kenyan cell will go up and be depolarized. That's the phase of the projection neuron relative to the field potential here. Now, the projection neurons go onto the lateral horn, excite the lateral horn neurons, and the lateral horn neurons then move back to the Kenyan cells. That's the phase of the spike of the lateral horn neuron in relation to the field potential. You see it's 180 degrees lagged relative to that of the projection neurons. So 180 degrees later, what you get is a spike in the lateral horn neuron that will put an IPSP onto the Kenyan cell. And that's what you see here. So at every cycle of this oscillation, the Kenyan cell will see a pattern of input that comes from projection neurons that's interrupted at 180 degrees out of phase with the excitatory input with an IPSP coming from the lateral horn neurons. The difference between the two inputs is that this one is specific. It comes from a small subset of projection neurons, whereas that one is unspecific. So what you'll get is at each cycle, a specific input to a Kenyan cell turned off by an unspecific IPSP.
That's the local field potential location of the Kenyan cells?
The Kenyan cell is roughly the same as the lateral horn neuron. The spike of the spike of the Kenyan cell occurs very similarly. It's about that. It's in the falling phase of the lateral horn neuron.
Then there's just a sign convention I'm confused on. I mean, the local field potential should be like flipped compared to the intracellular potential. So you're getting inhibitions to the inside of the cells becoming more negative. The outside.
The field potential here represents. The obviously the current flow that occurs within that structure as a result of the inputs that come from all the inputs that the Kenyan cells receive. And those are the excitatory input coming from the protection neurons and the inhibitory input coming from the lateral horn neurons. That's all. It's purely empirical. It's not clear why, but that's right. But I'm not saying that there's anything special. It's just empirical. They happen to be 180 degrees out of phase. I agree with you. So what's interesting here from when you put those things together is that you can characterize each cycle of this oscillation as providing each Kenyan cell with a volley of excitatory inputs that are specific, followed by an non-specific inhibitory input. And if it happens that a given Kenyan cell is excited sufficiently, you activate those active voltage-dependent conductances, and you make the cell more narrowly specific to coincident input. Its integration window shrinks. Okay, so it becomes more specific to temporally co-occurring inputs during that time window. The period is about 40 to 50 milliseconds. 40 to 50, the period is 40 to 50. It's a 20 to 30 hertz oscillation. Okay, so the two inputs are about 20 milliseconds, 15 to 20 millisecond interval between them. So, well, that's just a prediction. And I'll show you what happens. So the hypothesis is that the Kenyan cells will become the encoders, cycle-specific encoders of the input that they receive. Okay, so you should expect, if that is true, that their responses should be brief, because the pattern of PN input varies and evolves over time. So a given Kenyan cell, if it receives a specific combination of PN inputs at a given time, we'll see a different one later on in the response. So if it's specific, it should be brief, okay? It should be specific, it should occur at very specific times, and it should be also order specific. And then finally, if all this is true, that is, if those responses become extremely specific, both in time and in stimulus space, the baseline should be low, because you're going to be looking at responses that are very sparse. You're going to get just a few spikes out of a Kenyan cell. And if you want to be able to determine whether it is so, baseline had better be low. And so we did experiments to try and first do exactly that, characterize the baseline activity in the Kenyan cells and compare that with the baseline activity in the projection neurons. So they're simultaneous recordings, again, using tetrodes from the projection neurons here in the antenna lobe and here from the Kenyan cells, one synapse downstream. Here is 10 seconds. It's in fact 100 seconds. That's the average activity of Kenyan cells is extremely low. Those cells don't fire at baseline. They're essentially silent. So second, let's look at the way in which they respond to input. So these are first intracellular recordings. And what I'm doing here is holding a cell at a given potential. And during the stimulus, in this case it's air, actually depolarizing the cell, because it will allow us to see much better the sub-threshold activity patterns that we see, both the EPSPs and the IPSPs. Okay? The IPSPs happen to have a reversal potential which is very close to rest, so that if you didn't depolarize, you wouldn't see them very well. So here is an example of a response to air. Air doesn't evoke oscillations and patterns in PNs, and indeed you don't see any field potential oscillations here, and you don't see any response in the Kenyan cell. Now, here is an odor, and this odor evokes a change in patterning, at least in that Kenyan cell. It evokes also these field potential oscillations. So that represents the average activity across all projection neurons. That represents the inputs that this Kenyan cell receives to this in response to this particular stimulus. Now, look at the patterning of the response that you see there. You get alternating EPSP and IPSP, EPSP, IPSP, EPSP, IPSP. Every cycle here is represented by an alternation of EPSPs that come from the projection neurons and then the IPSP that is a feed forward through those lateral horn neurons. Okay?
Can we get to be in
lower rate than the actual.
No, in some cases you don't see them because there's noise, etc. So you don't see all of them, but they're exactly locked. All of them are exactly locked to the field potential. So I'll show you another.
So why can't you use the field potential with mainly the projection neuron signal? Why is it not also the lateral horn?
It may very well contribute a lot to the field potential. That could very well be, yeah. In terms of numbers, there's many more projection neurons than there are lateral horn neurons. But in terms of total synaptic inputs, exactly, it might be very similar. So that's an example of the same cell now in response to another odor. And again, you see this dominance of inhibition. The cell is actually inhibited during the response. But at certain cycles, you can see that it evokes very strong EPSPs. You can see those that have been amplified relative to the ones that are received at other cycles, like here and there. Those two EPSPs are large. In fact, there's a third one here that's so large that you get a spike out of the cell. And if you repeat that stimulus several times here, so that's the same slide as before, that's four trials, including the one showed before, and align them on the stimulus onset, you can see again that at those trials, there is a large EPSP here, for example. And then a couple of cycles later, you again have, on average, a strong EPSP. In this case, in this third case here, you get in two out of the four trials, you get a strong enough EPSP to get a spike. So it's as if at that particular time, that Kenyan cell appears to receive sufficient input to amplify the PSP to reach threshold and evoke an action potential in at least 50% of the trials. This is with the depolarization. So if you didn't depolarize, that cell would not respond, right? And in fact, in 90% of the cells, you will never see a response. And if you're in extracellular recordings, you see nothing. If you're in intracellular recording and you depolarize the cell, you see an inhibition. But of course, you never see it in extracellular recording or when you look at spikes. So what really happens for the majority of the cells is that superimposed on this very low baseline activity, you have inhibition that comes through this feed forward. But a very few selected cells will have, at a given cycle, the right set of inputs converging onto them.
Sorry, 90% of the cells you can't drive with any odor?
Yeah, with any odors that we can try, right? We usually try about 20. So it's extremely rare to find a cell that responds. So
this phase locking is after some 2 seconds or so? This amazing phase locking for 35.
Here it's about 800 milliseconds after the onset. Yeah. So here is an example of the kind of stuff that you get from a typical Kenyan cell now in extracellular recording, so that's in tetrode recordings. We can record at the same time probably about 20 to 30 Kenyan cells. Most of them are like this and you get nothing. You get spikes, but there is nothing that occurs and that's very specific to a particular odor. But then every so often you get something like this where for that particular odor, that cell will actually respond. And it will respond with very few spikes. It will respond with 2 spikes in this case. And if we zoom in on these spikes, what you'll see is that they line up, in particular this one, line up incredibly well with the stimulus. There is a second one that probably occurs in a fraction of the cases. And at the first few trials, and I didn't go through that, maybe later on we can go through it. At the first few trials, these are the trials when the system is not organized yet and where synchronization is very, very, the oscillatory power is very low when we analyze it in the field potential. So the system is responding highly, but not organized and not temporally precise yet. And again, you can see that the alignment of the spikes is not very good yet, but as soon as you get at trial 3, then you get a very reliable response. Say again? 30 seconds between trials. And then we go here, we wait here 45 minutes to a second series, which is 45 minutes later. Same odor.
6 seconds?
The odor itself is 1 second. And we store 30 seconds of data. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
So, I mean, in the laboratory setting, you've pasted the fly down, but early on you said that what the fly is doing is it's actually cutting back and forth through the plume. So is this your idea that the animal is going back and forth through the plume and then it normally doesn't have a punctate. The odor is not turning on in a punctate way. So,
mm-hmm.
So if it was tracking a plume, it would never see something like this. But your idea is it's cutting through a plume.
Right. So I have 10 slides on that later on with a plume stimulation paradigm. Maybe we can do that later on this afternoon or tomorrow, where I can show you that.
But that's sort of your notion, that you have to be cutting through a stimulus, so it has to be a sharp onset of the
odor. It is. That's how it is. Okay. That's just how it is. And every time you will get, you'll cross a filament of odorized air, you'll get this activity that will be distributed through the system, will go on for some time, and then downstream you'll have these guys that appear to detect these very specific coincidences.
So to ask a good question, I mean, the psychophysics you would predict would be such that if somehow you prevented the animal from cutting plumes, thousands of jets.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that the animal wouldn't do recognition, that it would have to have the ability to cut the plume.
It's actually been done. In moths, it's been done. If you put a moth in laminar flow in such a way that it receives olfactory input in any region of space that it flies in, it's unable to orient in it. And if you put them in a turbulent flow, they go through their typical behavioral pattern, which is casting. They'll orient upwind, and then they'll fly upwind, casting across the plume, determining where the edges of it are. So it's been shown very, very well that you need intermittency to arrive at least orientation, and probably also recognition.
You mean
because
gradient in order.
No, not gradient. I mean, in this case, it's absolutely not clear at all that gradient is used. The animal just needs to identify the position of the volume that contains odorant and move upwind. That's where the odor comes from. So in that kind of orientation, that's actually a relatively easy problem to solve.
This long time scale of 30 seconds. So something happens from 3 to 5, like that sets the clock and
makes it accurate.
Do you have any clue?
Well, that's okay. So I didn't go into this, but I think that's what's incredible about the system. The clock is like a DALI clock.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's elastic, but it's adaptive. Because every time, if you look at a given oscillation cycle, every time you have some delay in the excitatory input that will give the EPSP onto a Kenyan cell, that same delay will occur at the output to the lateral horn neuron and therefore at the IPSP also. So every time, the timing of the EPSP and the IPSP will be self-adjusted and they'll move together.
Yes, but what sets the clock to be now from try to try after 2-3 times, then it's exactly repeatable after, you know, 1 second.
Right, right.
It arrives just in time. But it takes 2-3 hours to reach this accuracy.
Yeah.
Do you have any clue from the recordings of what happens? What is the difference between the first ride and the third ride?
We're looking at that at the moment. I haven't shown you the data, but I'll show you the data so that you can really see what happens between the first and the following trials. There's very clear decrease in firing rate. There are very clear increase in temporal precision, and that appears to be due in part to an increase in the amplitude of the IPSPs that are caused by local feedback within the antenna lobe. So there's, and we're testing that with Maxim at the moment in simulations, simply by playing around with the inhibitory synaptic weights within the antenna lobe. And that seems to work very well. Just by increasing local inhibition within the circuit, you decrease local global activity, but you increase temporal precision. And so the timing and the duration, the reliability of the cycle duration is a function of the dynamics of the IPSPs, basically. Okay. So this, if you want a strong conclusion, the two main things that I wanted to try and pass by you are, one, you use temporal processing early in olfactory processing so as to decorrelate. And you add to this oscillatory patterning, and you're going to use that downstream to try and compress these decorrelated representations. So the result of this is that this odor representation that was distributed over a very large number of projection neurons, which is good because it's decorrelated over time, it's extremely redundant. But what you do by doing this is recompress that over a very small number of Kenyan cells that are going to be very specific. They're going to respond to very few odors. They're going to respond with very few spikes at very specific times. But your odor memory, if you want to store that, will now be contained in the activation pattern of a very, very small number of cells. So what I would love to have from you is some ideas about what's important and problematic about sparseness, and what optimal levels you would want to have in a system that in which you want to store odor memories, and why it is that the system seems to have evolved that way. But these are the two strong conclusions that I would pass by you, and I look forward to your feedback. Thank you.
So it's yet another sensory system where the cluster of nature likes changes in space and changes in time. You're always thinking derivatives.
Yeah, but I mean, what I like here is the fact that time is actually used only there, and you throw it away afterwards.
No, I mean, as far as the sensation.
Sure. But in a sense, we can develop that later, but it appears that as you compress the representation into a very small subset of Kenyan cells, in principle, time is not useful anymore, because that subset is specific. So the whole problem, which is something that usually I get several questions about that, which is how do you decode that temporal pattern, is that in the end, you might not need to decode it at all. The system sort of optimizes the representation by decorrelating it, and then it recompresses it into a small spatial pattern.
And what is looking here is just a result of the processing, but doesn't have the accurate timing.
Yeah.
Doesn't have any use for later.
Well, no. I mean, we have to figure that out. Exactly. According to that idea, is that in principle, in fact, when we look at the downstream cells, 50% of them are not phase locked. So at least 50% of the cells don't appear to care about the field potential at all. So you could very well imagine that nowhere in the system is the temporal pattern decoded. It's only used as a tool to decorrelate your representations. And then you recollapse everything, and you have very sparse representations. Of course, by sparsening, you lose something. You lose the detail. You lose the components and all the stuff that you could reconstruct from all the projection neuron patterns. And you could not from the small sparse patterns there. So that's a price you pay, presumably. But again, it matches well olfactory psychophysics. You cannot segment odors. So, this is really important.
If you just have one spike, so what else can you do? Just the timing of this spike carries information.
It's the grandmother cell. It's spiked, right? So you can imagine a downstream cell that. So imagine that over this duration, you will have some Kenyan cells that will respond to all of the cycles, right? One of them will respond to this cycle, another one to that one, and so on. Imagine an integrator downstream that absolutely doesn't care about the temporal structure. It simply sums all that. That combination of inputs represents that odor. End of story. You have forgotten everything that was contained in that trajectory, but it's all there.
So if the spatial temporal pattern becomes really sparse, then the decoder might have the option of just throwing out the time.
Exactly. So you've only used time here to optimize, and then you throw it away.
So to be consistent, the decoding must happen when the decorrelation has been done.
The decoding is done over the duration. And the problem is that here, your decorrelation has not occurred well yet. So there may be overlap, spatial overlap, between the patterns of Kenyan cells that you might have. I mean, we don't know that. That's something we're going to test. But you might have sparse representations, but significant overlap between them there. But if you wait long enough, then the overlap will decrease, simply because the identity of the Kenyan cells active later on here will differ across different odors. And so the sparse ensembles will overlap less and less with one another. So whether or not you've decorrelated and exploited the decorrelation to a maximum depends on how much time you've been able to integrate over the stimulus. And you know that may be why we sniff many times, and we sniff for a significant amount of time. And you know, we just We do more than integrating over time, but presumably we're formatting that and exploiting time to do that. In fact, when we look at plumes, and I'll show you the data later on, the plume filaments are incredibly short. They're about 70 milliseconds or so. So the actual stimulus itself is extremely short, but the temporal patterns that you get out of that are much, much longer. They can be half a second to a second. So the system is pushed, even by a very transient input, the system is pushed to evolve for a period of time that greatly outlasts the stimulus. Okay, thank you.